across the UK, online and on DAB.
Late Night with Rufus Hound, in for Ian Lee on Talk Radio.
Take a trip into the alternate reality of Late Night Radio.
I think I'm in something like The Matrix, and so are you.
Speech Radio, the difference.
Is there anybody out there?
Late Night with Rufus Hound, in for Ian Lee on Talk Radio.
I have eaten an artisanal pizza. I have followed that up with an ice cream sundae. They suggest for two people. I then had a cup of very strong coffee. And I'm with you for the next 3 hours, you lucky mother... Hi there, Rufus Hound here. I was doing that in the hope that at some point my earphones would kick in, I'd be able to hear myself, but they didn't. There's a little knob to twiddle under the desk. Oh, now it's working. Here you go, here I am. So exciting. Hello, friends. It's your old pal Rufus here, standing in for Ian Lee. Or am I, let's be honest, standing in for Jamie East, who is in turn standing in for Kath, who would in turn be standing in for Ian Lee. Oh, what a wicked web we weave when we linger to deceive. There'll be a Shakespearean scholar listening to this. In fact, there'll be a sea of Shakespearean scholars rushing to the phone to correct me on that. But anyway, none of it really matters. I'm quite hepped up on carbohydrates and sugar and caffeine and basically ready to play by the rules of the late night alternative, which pretty straightforwardly are that you pick up the phone, you decide what you want to talk about, and we talk. But what's the phone number, Roof? Well, it's 03444991000, you bloody idiot. or you can text us, start your message with the word talk, and send your message to 87222. But what would be the point of that, really? It's talk radio. I mean, if you just want me to read stuff out, it's boring. You could just tweet it, couldn't you? But you can also tweet us at Talk Radio, and we'll read those out as well. I think the idea, basically, is that this is meant to be, you know, oh, we're having a lovely debate here. Anything could happen with a lovely debate, and we want you to get stuck in. But it never really works like that, does it? Basically, somebody sets something up, and the next person wants to talk about something entirely different, and then eventually it will end up with me recommending comic books and things I've watched on Netflix, and people phoning in to just ask how Ian is. So to nip that in the bud, I can tell you he is fine. There you go. That's as much as I know. And we'll be back soon. Good. Don't need to address that anymore. Hey, look, the switchboard's already lighting up here. It's flashing like an old man in a Mac. So let's start with Angela, who's in Leicester. All right, Angela.
Hi, Rufus. You right?
I'm very good. How are you?
Not too bad. Good to hear you anyway.
I'm just absolutely amazed that you're not caddick, Angela. This is... something's gone spectacularly adrift.
I try and get on before, like, sometimes I drift off if I'm really tired, and then sometimes I stay a whole wait to listen to it, and then go in and out, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, get in early to avoid disappointment, Angela.
Yeah.
You've
done
well.
Early. Yeah, we've got to keep the show going strong, ain't we?
That's it. If nobody phones in, it's just me whistling, and nobody needs that, least of all shepherds. So, Angela, what's going on in your life?
Not much. It's the same, like, the same boring, the last time I spoke, you know, when I've been a bit poorly when I spoke to you a few times.
Yeah.
I was restricted to hospital a couple of weeks back. It was my asthma, and they said I was on the verge of having pneumonia.
Oh, crumbs.
It's because of the... When you got asthma, it tends to grab you more,
yeah.
Don't it? Yeah.
Well, it's all lungs, isn't it? It's all the breathing gear that's going wrong. But have they put you on tablets?
Yeah, they were going to put me on a drip, but they because my neck.
What, they were going to balance you on top of Jacob Rees-Mogg? Hello. Sorry.
No,
there's a heavy satire there.
I'm older than him as well. And I'm not even in Parliament, mate. And, it was just a bad time. And they ran my mum up because she's still my next of kin.
All right,
and they said, well, not if she wants to hear this place scream down with the needle stuck in the body. Have you got an alternative? And they said, yeah. Yeah.
So no drip?
No, not yet.
And you were pleased about that?
I was a little pleased. I tell you what, there was this place they were going to take me to, and I was a little bit... they were going to take me to the ward, and I said, I'm not going down there because that was creepy. And I thought, no. Computer said no.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not a qualified medical practitioner, Angela. And it would be wrong for me to try and diagnose anybody or make suggestions over the phone. But with all the different medicines and all the things they've tried, have you considered just getting a bottle of scotch and looking wistfully out of a window for an hour?
I have, don't you?
A cold, just a lovely wistful look out at an often grey, bleak English scene.
So I have done it.
Settles my nerves somewhat.
I've done it before, but because it was the bad winter period, I just couldn't. I crouched in my bedroom and I was listening to Joe Seal.
Not for good reasons, I'm guessing.
For good reasons. It was just one of them things, and it's like the winter is just too... Because I'm older now. And
that's how time works. Bloody linear chronology. It'll be the death of all of us. And I mean that literally.
And I could fight it off like I normally do.
Yeah, all you can do is stand your ground against the biological forces that ravish us all. But you've been a bit more ravaged than most.
I'm a bit stubborn, so I'm a bit cold.
That's how you stare these things down. Sometimes, I'm always quite torn with this because I'm a big fan of evidence, Angela. I like people to have done a study, and I like for people to take the results of that properly, you know, peer-reviewed study, like proper medical studies, not the sort of study where it says Greg's found out this week that most people are 19% pasty. Not that sort of thing. Like actual evidence-based stuff. And all of the links with things like depression and whatever, you know, it's like, no, it's a genuine medical thing. It can be studied. There's chemicals that are in the brain that can bring all those things on. There's, you know, it's a point-attable thing. And then sometimes with colds and whatever, I think it is sometimes just comes to staring them down and bloody getting on with it.
Yeah. I wish they, I've got something. I wish I could, I've been trying to write to different people about it. Theresa May did actually touch on it a little bit. And I wish they could talk about, like, physical, mental health issues because they all link.
Yeah.
And...
in fairness, and I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm definitely to the left of most of the people who nurse this microphone in this illustrious station. But old Corbyn, to his credit, has raised the issue of funding for mental health services a number of times.
And just find the democracy stretch now, because we're not talking about the things that people need to sort out.
If people need to sort out?
You know, what we want to discuss about in Parliament is just so...
Yeah, but everything, these days, everything's blooming Brexit, isn't it? And even the things that aren't, there's no room for those in the national conversation. So we have no idea about half the stuff that isn't Brexit-based that's actually, you know, being done in Parliament.
Yeah, and I just find it all, like, tiring. I get a little bit frustrated on Parliament, but they've brought this on themselves, to be fair, and I know why I did vote for Leave, but no one ever asked me.
Right.
But...
when you say they brought this on themselves, what's the this to which you refer, Angela?
Well, actually, you know, my age group, I can't really, I was a big fan of Margaret Thatcher, I've stood up for her several times. And when she went, the way she went, the way the older generation that is now, and they put the knife in her because they knew that she'd win that last term.
Right.
And they never let people had to vote to actually let to see who, if she got in or not.
Yeah.
So they did put the knife in everyone.
But she'd been, by that point, she'd been Prime Minister for what? Was it 11 years, 12 years?
Yeah, 12 years. Yeah. And then, and to me, that was like, I had a meltdown because she was my rock. I did all the courses that they gave me, and I was doing the last one, which was quite expensive, very expensive. And when I come home, my family told me, and I thought, my dad looked at me, he says, you're going to get revenge on that house, big time. And when this came around, and then David Cameron came in, I thought, you're a loser. And I thought, I was tapping my foot for 2 years, and I said, we'll have you out eventually.
Yeah.
And when this came about, I think people just had enough, and then my brain snapped. And it's nothing to do with the EU. If there was a stronger MP in the time, I would have remained. But my brain was like, you ruined my future. I had it in my hand, and then you took her away from me. And I remember that night. And there's my sister and my brother holding my hand, hysterical, because what went through in my health. I was just in meltdown, Rufus. It's not fair, mate.
No. I'm a bit lost though, Angela, in all of that, to know what the event itself was. Are you talking about when Thatcher was ousted, your brain snapped, or when Cameron got in, your brain snapped? I lost that bit.
It more Cameron when he got in, but I got a bit. He just reminded me of, oh God, what's his name? Another one. But, my brain snapped when he got in.
Right. Because of what? Because certainly in the last, well, since Thatcher left office, the Prime Minister that we have enjoyed, I suppose would be one way of looking at it, who's closest to Thatcher would be Cameron, so I would have thought you'd have been delighted.
Yeah, no, he would have been delighted in anything. He was just...
No, not him, just, you, Angela, sorry.
No, I wasn't delighted because he was one of the... He was one of the young ones that she cloned. But
if you liked her, then surely you'd want one of her clones.
No, not him. But anyway...
Well, then who?
There was... John Major was all right. He was pretty okay.
Yeah, but he was in the House of Lords by the time Cameron came around, so who?
Because John Major was in after her. But we should have had a vote.
Yeah, but what I was saying was, if not Cameron, who? And what I'm saying, when you said John Major was all right.
I see what you mean. Cameron, I don't know.
Yeah.
I think there should have been a change of leader when Cameron was in.
Do you?
Yes.
He was seen to be a pretty steady hand on the tiller by people of a blue persuasion, though.
I'm sure.
I mean, up until the Brexit vote, don't get me wrong, I was no fan of the man and remain unconvinced by him and his leadership and the ideology of austerity. As people who've heard me on this radio show before will know, I largely view austerity as a lie. And the evidence I offer you for that is when he was talking to the Fire Brigades Union just after the financial crash, one of the firemen said, so, OK, we're going to take these cuts, but when the economy comes back, all of these services will be reinstated, will they? And Cameron literally goes, no. Like, it was ideologically based. It was how could they shrink the payout that the state was making as much as possible, which is, don't get me wrong, on some level, a true blue conservative aim. There's no need to hide it necessarily, but to the wider population, it was dressed up as being... a vital necessity when every country that bounced back from the global financial crash, let's remember that, it wasn't a crash brought about by Labour, it was a global financial crash. Every other country said, no, you don't cut public services at that point, you invest more heavily in them because the money trickles up, trickle down, economics is a lie. We were the only country that didn't put money in at the bottom, instead pursued the ideology of austerity, and it's taken our economy longer to recover than all other developed countries.
Mm. Well, I don't think he was the Prime Minister for what they wanted to achieve, the Conservatives, because at the end of the day, I think the country would have remained if he were in power.
Say that again for me one more time, Angela.
I said I don't think he was the right person for a Conservative leader at that time.
Yeah, but they
period.
Were dead in the water before him. They desperately needed a PR man, and that is exactly what they got in old ham face.
Yeah, but we didn't do any of this good. I mean, it split us all up.
Well, no, the Brexit vote did. The whole point of the Brexit vote was to offer one to the country and then watch the country reject it, and then he could quell the voices within his own party that were demanding greater freedom from the EU. And it backfired massively. We are now learning through campaigns that were largely founded on some very unpleasant instincts that people have about things with which they are not familiar and scared of. And increasingly, it seems, like the kind of interference that has been alleged to have happened in the last American election was happening here as well, where foreign states who seek to disrupt the smooth running of established nations who historically have had a bit more say in the way of, you know, global affairs, to disrupt them and to undermine them, which is exactly what we're experiencing now.
Yeah, but I'm not trying to say, Rufus, like, when he changed the benefit thing, and I was 46, I think, and our jobs, okay, my money's fine, but the job centre tried to contact me a few years ago, and I thought, oh, what's that for? And then they rang me, and they said I should have been on such and such a benefit, they'd sorted it out, and they back paid me from 2014 to 2015, so come on, who's a loser here then? I'm right. A winner. They taught me so good.
But then how could you...
I mean, you know what I mean?
I think there is some disconnect between the idea of seeking to protect the benefits somebody, you know... If I want to protect the benefits I receive and the entitlements that I'm due, voting Conservative rarely seems like the way to enshrine those things. That would largely be, you know, the understood pattern of these things.
But I rang the job centre to say thank you for the money, but they said I didn't need to say thank you because it was mine anyway.
You're due it, yeah.
But I'm always polite anyway.
Well, as am I, which is why I will say, Angela, may angels carry you to your rest, and thank you so much for your call. It has been a delight, a joy, and a right old eye-opener.
Across the UK, online and on DAB.
Late Night with Rufus Hound, in for Ian Lee on Talk Radio.
I'm thinking of bringing in a little extra part of that sting that just says, get your listening gear around this! And then just chant lads for 25 minutes. I think that would help pad out the show. I don't know, might work. Or we could just take more calls. For example, from G. Hello, G.
Rufus.
Keep that barking up. We can pad it out. We're almost at the halfway point of the first hour. I think a solid 17 minutes of barking. Here we go. Start the timer. Hang on, I'm just seeing a text in from the people that run Talk Radio. Apparently that is not viewed as being quality output. Rather damning.
Okay, let's go for some quality output then.
Let's have some quality output. That's another new sting we're going to need.
My best friend died today.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that, G.
No, don't be. It was a... Yeah.
He
was a lovely person.
Yeah.
Whilst he was alive.
Yeah.
Why can we no longer stand up and say, when someone dies, they were an idiot? Because he was, mate. He was an idiot.
Now, had he been unwell for a while, or has this come out of the blue?
He suffered, as a lot of us do, with mental health issues.
Right, yeah.
But he knew that he suffered from mental health issues. And I'm just wondering, if you know that you suffer from mental health issues...
Yeah.
does that quantify you being a dick?
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting, isn't it?
Isn't it just?
Well, because
I suffer from mental health issues, and I'm a dick sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah, it's I once worked with a bloke who was an absolute... I mean, he drove me... and I'll pick my words carefully, bearing in mind we're talking about mental health. But he induced within me a nervous condition, the like of which I had previously not experienced.
Oh, you've met my wife.
Lovely fella. but, you know, people used to say to me, oh, no, he's just insecure, he's insecure. Like... Once you could say
F off from the room opposite from me.
Oh, well, that will happen.
Sorry, love.
If you're making wife jokes on national radio, I think she reserves the right there. I can't take your side on this one, G.
Sorry,
but no. All I mean is, if you have a room full of people saying, "Oh no, he only acts like he's so insecure," does that then pull the rug out from under the fact that yeah, that might well be, but he's also an absolute, you know, nightmare, egomaniac, narcissist, you know, call it what you will, but
his
behaviour is abhorrent, but just because, oh, no, but he's insecure, oh, in that case, it's fine. It's a bit the same with mental health issues, isn't it? To a point, it's like, you still got to try and be decent to the people around you, but it all boils down to kindness, ultimately, doesn't it? Because the whole point of how we talk about these things and taking the stigma...
When you have a voice in your head telling you that you are a complete and utter... Do you have an override button for that voice?
I'm not... forgive me, it's not that I'm saying it's your responsibility to be kind, more that it is the ongoing effort that we all should have to be as kind as we can to one another, because that effort will itself bring about better results for people who are going through it and people who are suffering around the people who are going through it.
So, say I was asked to do a eulogy for my greatest friend.
Yeah.
Would I be remiss in standing up and telling... Is the word congregation? Is that the word?
Well, in
gathering,
so much as they congregate.
Congregation,
I would personally opt for assemblage. Assembly. Yeah.
There's a word, assemblage. Would I be remiss in standing up and telling the assemblage that he was a complete and utter... Complete and utter, not upper.
Yeah. Well, I think you've got to read the room. You know, I've been to a number of funerals, but and one of the great curses of getting older
of
is that the older you get...
Him.
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying, I guess, is I've been to funerals where people have told very candid stories about the departed, and it's actually been a real balm in the room. And I've been to funerals where, you know, somebody who everybody knew was deeply flawed is now being portrayed as some sort of angelic figure sent from the heavens above. And it feels disingenuous.
How do you process that, though?
Huh?
How would you process that, though? If someone stood up in front of the assemblage and said, this guy was perfect in every single way, do you sit there and accept that?
Yes. Yes, that's what you do, yeah. Because you're at a funeral and that's how you behave.
Is that human, or is that because we actually don't give an F?
No, look. I don't know. There's nothing to get on your high horse about there. You're at a funeral. If people are just saying things you don't agree with, you don't go, I can take this no more!
Yes, but you could stand up in the assemblage and say, no, this man was a complete and utter...
But then you'd be the dick in that situation.
Exactly.
However,
he was the D in that situation in the first place, because he's the one that caused it.
No. Your logic's gone all wonky there, fella. That's like me saying, you know, I can't believe you threw my birthday cake in the bin. That's why I weed on it before you had any.
But it was a bag of shite.
Yeah, but do you see that we can all of us, all of the time in our lives, point at reasons we feel justify our own bad behaviour? The only way that we improve the world around us is to park our rejection of things we find objectionable and behave ourselves in the way that we would like to see everyone behave.
So it's nice to be nice.
It's nice to be. If you can't say nothing nice, don't say anything at all. Especially at a funeral. And that is, let's be honest, the joy of a wake. Because the wake is, you know, the funeral, the official business, standing in front of the vicar is, oh, he was a very nice man. Oh, vicar, he was a very nice man. You should definitely have a word with the big fella upstairs and get him in. Oh, he was a lovely bloke, this fella. And then you sit around in the pub afterwards going, do you know, he got right on my nerves when we went on that holiday.
But isn't that being contradictory?
No.
If you sit there after the fact and say, oh, he was a complete and utter cheat.
Yeah, I think you're getting confused between a funeral and a jury, no, a courtroom situation. There is absolutely no reason to tell the truth in church. In fact, one could argue, especially in light of current
news... There's absolutely no reason to tell the truth in court.
Well, no, there is, and that is legally defined. There's very much an obligation to tell the truth in court.
So why is there no obligation to tell the truth in church?
Because it serves a different purpose. I've got him. That's it. I've outdone him. He's up against the ropes, the fella. He can't look up.
I'm done.
It's a different thing. No, look, let's just see this through to its logical conclusion, right?
Okay.
A funeral. So I looked in a little while ago. If you've heard me on this before, I've definitely talked about it before.
Bearing in mind, I have to go to a funeral very soon.
Yeah, yeah.
My best friend has just died.
No, I'm
in front of the people and tell them what I thought of him.
Yeah, but I suppose this is what I'm getting at, really, is I would define myself as an atheist were it not for the fact that logic dictates all I can ever be is an agnostic. It is a ridiculous position to take to say that you know that there is no God. We have no way of knowing God, therefore you can't know that there isn't one.
Right.
Everything I understand...
There is, or there isn't.
Yeah, exactly. I cannot say no unequivocally either way.
But within anything to state that there is or there isn't.
So all I can therefore ever be is agnostic. If I'm asking other people to apply logic to what they believe, then I must do the same. Therefore, I am agnostic. But there is lots of brilliant things about church.
There's always a book, Rupert.
No, there are lots of brilliant things about church. Community, being part of something, being part of a network that's actively looking out for the emotional well-being and all of those kind of things. But also the actual churchy bit itself. The singing and the moments to think about some issues slightly, you know, bigger than the minutiae of our own existence. All of those sorts of things.
The way that the church is built by usually the pagan society.
Well, that's it, isn't it? Why do we have Christmas at Christmas when, you know, the maths dictates that Jesus was born in April? Well, it's because, you know, the church overtook the pagan existing midwinter festivals and also the festivals that used to be about, hooray, spring is here. So that's why we have Easter and Christmas where we have them. But anyway, that's all by the by. My point is that I go to a non-faith assembly. It's called Sunday Assembly, which is why I use the word assemblage. And it functions in many ways the same way that a church does, but there aren't prayers and there's no huge talking of God in all of that. But it's the business of being part of it. So at the end of our lives, that ceremony where people gather together who knew and cared for the person who's left us is about about marking the end of somebody's life, but also having a point from which we can deal with our own feelings and our own grief. Now, that can't just be swept aside in, you know, a couple of hours in a church. It will be an ongoing process. When we lose people, they are wounds that we carry with us for the rest of our lives, and we merely navigate our way around the hurt. The hurt doesn't necessarily diminish. It just becomes more dealable. So, funerals have their part to play as a ceremony by which we communally are kind to one another in our feelings about having lost somebody. Therefore, you haven't got to stand up and say, I'll tell you about this son of a, you know. It hasn't got to be that, because you're as there as much for the people left behind as you are to, you know, to claim some specific truth to the person who died. So you haven't got to stand up there. But what you can do
is point out
to the room that this was a flawed person, that they weren't perfect, that you recognise who they were in reality and in truth. And people, I think, would appreciate that honesty because it is part of that ceremony. But you don't have to say, if I don't tell the truth now, you know, I'm committing some heinous, either, you know, moral or actual crime.
So celebrate the human as a human.
Talk about why you will miss them. And the reason that you'll miss them is for the time that you share together and the places in your life where you know in your immediate grief that you will think on them. And if you share that with people who knew that person, they will thank you for it.
Rufus. Ow, do you do that?
Well, kindness, friend, kindness.
I try kindness every single day.
Yeah, but kindness is easy.
It always comes back to bite me on the ass.
No, but kindness is easier when you've got a bit of leeway. And I'm very lucky in that I'm in a position where my, you know, if I don't get paid for working at Talk Radio for a few weeks, that isn't the difference between my family eating and not eating. It is easier for me to be kind because I am on, you know, more affluent than somebody who's on the, you know, on the knife's edge. And when you're on the knife's edge, it's much, much harder to be kind. So it is a privilege. It is born of privilege, my ability to say to people, be kind. But it is
there
my privilege. I had a good mum and dad. I was given some opportunities. I have been lucky in all sorts of ways. So for me to say to people who haven't had the same breaks that I've had, oh, you know, be kind, is, you know, and not understand the reality of what other people are going through and why it's harder for them to be kind, then that's me mugging those people off. But
everyone
the,
has
the ongoing effort, exactly.
A privileged life.
Well, not necessarily has the opportunity to have a privileged life. We are all privileged.
But ability.
No, we're all privileged. That's the other thing. I was talking to my mate Steve about this just the other day. We are all of us privileged. It's about recognising what our privileges are.
Yes.
And if you're, you know, if you're in
and
a wheelchair, you know, with one arm and, you know, you've got a gun to your head and whatever, there's somebody with no wheelchair with a gun to their head who's in a worse situation than you are. So it's only ever about recognising, you know, when people say privilege, not to dismiss or deny anybody the right to their say. It's just that it's starting from your own place of saying, this is how I feel, but is a lot of the things I feel informed by the luck that I have experienced in this world? And once you factor that in, then it's much easier to be kind because you think, well, fair enough, that's their point of view because I haven't had the breaks I've had. But it's not easy. It's just the thing that we have to encourage in one another. The kinder we are to one another, the more kindness we ourselves will receive, the happier we will all be. Because when it's good for us, it's good for us.
I've listened. I've digested. And I thank you.
Let's take some ads.
Uncut, after-hours conversation for the up-all-night generation. Late Night with Rufus Hound. In for Ian Lee on Talk Radio.
Can't believe it. We're in the last third of the hour and we haven't yet heard from Andy Alan Caddick. Oh, there he is. Oh, normal service has been resumed. Thank God. You all right, Cadder?
I'm not mad, you?
Yeah, bobbing along nicely, Tart.
Which car?
I actually don't know. I think with Ian being off, it's a kind of chance to catch your breath and plan more award-winning radio.
Yeah, was you forewarned by Mr. Whale earlier?
By who?
James Whale.
Forewarned?
But I was calling in.
Well, listen, Caddick, I don't know how you feel this, you know, august broadcast institution works, but people don't really give you the heads up that Alan Caddick's phoning in the late night alternative. It is just assumed to be the case.
Well, James Ralph said he was going to warn you.
Oh, why? Were you on the phone to him earlier?
Yes.
I see. No, no, I think people just know that when you sit down at 10 o'clock, the AC is on, if you catch my drift.
I haven't seen any more extreme K-makers recently.
You haven't seen it recently? I don't think it's on at the moment, is it?
Yeah, it's a sketch of a chateau with Dick and Angel.
Oh, yeah. I like that Dick Strawbridge. I hung out with him a couple of times, and he got his son involved in doing stuff with him on the telly. They did like an eco house rebuild thing, and I once got his son absolutely battered in Soho and delivered him back to his dad some hours later. His dad just looked at me like, ah, yeah, thanks for that. This is why we live in the countryside, so I haven't got to deal with this sort of nonsense. Lovely fellas, the pair of them, and an excellent moustache.
They did the Hungry Sailors.
The Hungry Sailors?
Yeah.
You're not about to get... Is that a euphemism for something?
No, like the programme that Dick Strawbridge and his son did.
I don't quite know what you're saying, Cads. Say it one more time.
That was a programme that Dick and his son made.
There was a programme called The Hungry Sailors that Dick and his mates made.
No, Dick and his son.
Oh, his son made? Yeah. What, where they were just sailing around and then cooking what they caught?
Yeah.
I'd watch that. I'm really very in now to the full dad genre of telly. You set anything in a shed with a bloke with a spanner in one pocket and you've got me for an hour.
Well, I was watching something on Discovery Turbo earlier.
Oh, yeah. I love a bit of Discovery Turbo. Oh, yeah. Do you ever catch those... I don't actually know if they still do it, but they used to do... I'm trying to think what it was called. They did a series. It was a bloke who I think used to be a vet or a doctor or something on daytime BBC One, who then, it turned out, I think inherited a bit of a farm. And he was a farmer as well, but he had a garage. And in his garage, he used to build things. And they would churn these series out like 12 episodes ago. And it was called like A Classic Is Born. A Chopper Is Born. A Helicopter Is Born.
I know, with Mark Evans.
That was him, Mark. Yeah, Mark, what's his name?
Mark Evans.
Mark Evans, thank you. Yeah, and it was basically Mark Evans and his mate would, from a standing start, build, you know, some incredible piece of engineering, but it used to be... they'd start... They'd do, like, a full, like, run of an entire series, and it would start on, like, Friday at 11 o'clock at night, and if you stayed up until 4 o'clock the following morning, you basically watch this bloke build a helicopter from scratch. And I cannot tell you how many sunrises I saw hearing Mark Evans firing the engine on something that was almost certainly about to kill him.
Like building a carburetor for a racing car.
Yeah. Loved it. No, you've got me on those shows, Cads. You've got me on those.
Well, I'll tell you what is coming back. Who Wants to Be a Millionaire with Jamie Clarkson?
Well, it's come back.
No, there's a new series starting Monday.
I know, but look, mate, they reinvented it, what, just before Christmas? And I think they've already done one series and we're only in February. That doesn't count as a comeback to me.
But no one beats Chris Tarrant doing Millionaire.
Well, don't they? I mean, I quite like a bit of Clarkson. Isn't Clark... I think, you know, the Clarkson, May and Hammond thing, the thing that people miss is... The thing that people miss... is that their shtick is we're three old tossers. And we're going to be three old wobbly gammon tossers. But we're three old wobbly gammon tossers having a lovely time. And on the whole, if you can have a lovely time, I'll find that rather endearing until you start being out and out arseholes. Tossers, fine. Arseholes, got to draw a line. Draw a line round your arsehole, Caddick. That's what I'm telling you.
Yeah, but there's four sides to a square because you've got one important person.
Who?
Some say that he was born with three heads and that when we were doing his birth, he gave his name or some of it like that. All we know is he's called the Stig.
But the Stig changed about four times, didn't it? And now, on their version of Top Gear, which isn't called Top Gear, on one of the streaming services...
On Amazon.
They've got that brilliant German woman.
Sabine Smith.
Yeah, she's fantastic.
But she was on Top Gear with Chris Evans.
Is it the same woman then? Or maybe it's a different woman on the grand tour. He's gone. There are a lot of things Caddick will stand for. And anyone who's listened to Talk Radio before now will know he's been called every name under the sun. He's had caller after caller ringing up and slating him. And he's taken it all like a champ. But if you don't know which European female racing driver is currently working with Clarkson, Hammond and May, that is the straw that will break that Caddick camel's back. Just gone. A fit of pique. You could hear him, couldn't you? The clutch at the pearls. The opening of the door. The rain pouring down outside as he popped his fedora on his head. Peered back in through the lintel. And a look was enough. It's not often on speech radio that you can hear somebody trying to kill you with a look. But my gosh. My spine has rarely been so contracted as it was in that moment. I felt like a startled cat. Sweet baby Jesus, somebody's walked over my grave. The fury as that phone hit the cradle will be heard around the world for generations to come. There'll be a BT engineer outside his house tomorrow going, Alan, nobody's phoned, but we just know something's wrong. Because the switchboard at BT headquarters registered something that we have hitherto only experienced with a seismometer. The indignation felt in that moment registered on the Richter scale. Possibly the Richter scale. Such was the shadow of death I felt passing over me there. Friends. What can I tell you? I just didn't think... I'd never imagined being in this situation where Alan Caddick was the one hanging up on us. It has shaken me to the very core of my being. And whether or not I can continue with you over the next 2 hours, currently, is in some doubt. Just going to need to take a minute now just to gather myself. And it may well be there are people out there in the modern world who have been out on a few dates with somebody they met on the internet and they all thought everything was going well and then suddenly the texts don't come back. There's no reply on them. It's called ghosting. The young people in this modern dating world have this phenomenon where they think everything's going very well with somebody and then they just literally disappear from their lives. And it's a big problem. It really sincerely hurts people who are in the foothills of a new relationship and then suddenly dropped. No answers, no closure, no sense that they have been passed over for a reason. Just that almost deifically they have been judged to be not good enough. I've had ghosting explained to me before now by young people. With the dating apps, with the Tinders and the Bumblebees and the Grindhouse. And I've never really known what it would feel like. I was married in a different age, friends. When seeing a hot chick across the bar, you were only a phone call away to her father to ensure that marriage was inevitable. I've never had to do all that. I've never understood ghosting and the emotional turmoil that follows thereafter. But tonight I feel I've walked a mile in those ghostly moccasins, those spectral slip-ons. For tonight, friends, I have been ghosted by Caddick. What's he doing now, we wonder? Where is he? Oh, so many options present themselves to us, do they not? Stripped to the waist, howling at the moon, a copy of Radio Times in one hand, the light bouncing off his cash in the attic tattoo. Or has he stopped mid-howl to help an old lady cross the road? You've dropped your digestives, he says. He pops them back into her tartan shopping trolley. And she gazes at him, wondering if maybe this young man's like the sun she never hears from. the family that have rejected her. Because her breath smells of Caesar. Maybe he's in a pub car park, offering all comers, one by one, step up, no bet too large, no wager unmet. We don't know. And so we find ourselves here in that not knowing, shrouded in the mystery of it all. So many questions, our minds like the Riddler's suit. Where has he gone? What has become? And what has become of him? What will become of us? It was Dylan Thomas, of course, who famously wrote Rage. Rage against the dying of the light. In a poem he wrote about his dying father, asking him to find something within himself, to see off death, to gaze into the empty eyes of that hollow skull, to demand that it place the scythe to one side, pop back on its white horse and ride off again, to rise like a phoenix back to life. And I think in many ways, friends, that's what we're now being asked to do. And I'm sorry. I'm sorry if I sound emotional. I didn't think this was going to happen. He's just gone. He's just gone. And we're left here having to deal with that. I'm sorry. I promised myself I'd never cry on talk radio. I think what I need is just a couple of minutes. Just to collect myself. To reflect not on what has gone, but on what yet may be. That together, dwelling not on what has been lost, but for all the things that have been gained. For the good times. Those recaps on television that literally nobody other than Alan watches. The references to shows that nobody else remembers. The barely constructed full sentences that often didn't even have an adjective in them. We just need a moment, which we'll take now.
Across the UK, online and on DAB.
Late Night with Rufus Hound, in for Ian Lee on Talk Radio.
Experience the unconventional.
Hello.
The unpredictable.
What I'm going to say sounds ridiculous.
And the completely unorthodox.
Don't you think that's a bit weird?
You never know just where the conversation will take you.
Is that Commando?
Late Night with Rufus Hound, in for Ian Lee on Talk Radio.
Now, you know, I'm standing in for Ian Lee, and I'm not as au fait with all the technology here that, you know, runs how this works, but that little kid in the middle of that news report saying, "It's hot in the summer, I don't know how that happens," sounds like Donald Trump's approach to talking about anything to do with climate change. Because that's what it is, kid. It's climate change. Man-made or not, you know, if you want to talk about that, by all means, ring in. But with 99% of the world's scientists of every stripe saying that undoubtedly we have had an effect on the ongoing increase in global temperature, it does rather seem like the changes we're experiencing are something to be worried about. Although my dad had a very good line on this, which is, "Son, if it's come to the point where I'm not allowed to enjoy a sunny day, I don't know how much longer I want to stick around." A point of view with which I have a huge amount of sympathy. I had an ice cream. I mentioned it at the top of the show. I had a lovely ice cream after my dinner today, and it didn't feel incongruous. Anyway, this is the Late Night Alternative. How does it work? I'll tell you how it works. You phone in on 0344 499 1000, and we talk about whatever you want to talk about. one person who's done this, and like the centurion he is, been on hold now for 51 minutes, is our friend CJ.
Ah, worth the wait.
Only one thing better than a BJ, a CJ.
It's true.
Is that the official intro? That we...
I'm going to put that on my CV right now. Hang on.
Okay, we're just... Bum, 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 bum.
Okay, yeah.
I've done it.
And what I'll do is I'll quote you for that and say this is what Rufus said. And, you know, people will buy that, won't they?
They will, yep. Yep, that's a shoe-in for any job for which you apply.
Well, yeah, that's true. Can't think of any at the moment, but there you go. Did you get the same sense of dread and fear from that weather report as I did, or was that just me?
What, the weather report at the end of the news?
Yeah.
Fear and dread?
Well, where they're saying it's the hottest ever, and then you got a kid not knowing when what summer and winter is, so it's a combination of both kids to fit. and it's getting hot. So, yeah. You know, we're screwed, aren't we?
Well, possibly, yes. I mean, you know, I think... There's a funny way of thinking about problem solving, where... who was I listening to the other day? It was Neil Gaiman on a podcast.
Brilliant, isn't he, Neil?
A sensational writer, and everything I've seen of him being interviewed or heard of him being interviewed only assures me that my fandom of him is well founded.
It is. That's something I would aspire to be as a writer.
Oh, God.
Him. He's up there.
I think most of those that have picked up a keyboard, pen, or typewriter would feel the same. But he was saying that. Good Omens.
Oh, great book.
Which he co-wrote with Terry Pratchett at a point where Terry Pratchett had recently broken through to be, you know, the main man in British, you know, fantasies, you know, comic fantasy, that Neil Gaiman wasn't well known, and they befriended each other and agreed to write that book together. And then that book was a huge success, and then Neil Gaiman becomes the Neil Gaiman.
The thing.
And as Terry Pratchett was... preparing to shuffle his way from this mortal coil, he made him promise that the burgeoning deal to turn Good Omens into a TV thing would be done, and it would be done well. So Neil Gaiman went from being just a writer to now being a showrunner on this massive and very expensive Amazon project.
Didn't Neil do some Doctor Who episodes as well?
He did. He wrote one of my favourite ever Doctor Who episodes, which was the one where the TARDIS becomes... personified.
Oh,
played by Saran Jones. My God. Yeah, the Doctor's
Wife. That one.
It's a sensational episode. Anyway, Neil Gaiman was saying now that he's the showrunner on Good Omens, that because he wrote American Gods, and that was also made for Amazon.
Oh, that's fantastic.
And that's a great series as well. But he's often been talking to the producers and saying, well, you know, you need to do this scene, you need to do that scene. And they say, we can't afford it. But now he's been a showrunner, he realises the answer, we can't afford that, isn't actually an answer. Because all that means is we don't want to do that. The actual answer is, well, how much money do you have to do it? We'll do it for that money. Work out a way, be more inventive, and work out a way to do it for, you know, for the budget that you have.
Think outside the box before the box exists. That's what you got to do.
Yeah, I guess so. On some level, yeah. But I think in all walks of life, we are better charged not to say that something cannot be done, but to instead approach all problem solving as, okay, if we are going to do that, what do we need to do? And that's a bit how I feel about climate change. Is it's all very well and good people being kind of nihilistic about it, but it doesn't actually get us anywhere. If we are going to reverse the, you know, catastrophe of global warming, we can't start saying why it can't be done and must instead, you know, commit ourselves to working out what actually can be done and how.
We just wait for a solar minimum. There you go.
Just do a solar minimum?
Solar minimum. When the sun's at its least active, and it will cause like a sort of mini ice age. That'll sort it.
We just need a volume knob on the sun. Is that what it boils down to?
Pretty much. And we do a solar minimum quite soon, so the timing's good.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, I know. Great timing.
Well, that might buy us a bit of room. Whether or not, as a species and as a world, we're capable of doing it, time will tell. But
exactly.
Be nice to have a bit of an extension. some poetic chime there to the Brexit events of the day. That we might end up, I mean, you know, it's sort of the worst of all possible worlds that we just kick it into the long grass for another couple of months or whatever while we try and work out what we, you know, are going to do. But if we haven't worked it out over the last 2 years, it seems rather unlikely that another couple of months will make much of a difference. No. But there we go.
I find it exciting. Is that sad?
Well, it is sort of exciting in the same way that, you know, somebody trying to knock an apple off your head with a bow and arrow is exciting. As the blindfold goes on, you think, this is exciting.
Good.
Yeah.
There is something I did want to speak about tonight, and it's not an easy thing to speak about, but it's a recent experience I've had to do with online bullying, harassment and trolling.
Okay.
And I'll tell you the story of what happened in the last week. I run this page called Talent Stockport, and it promotes history and events, and it promotes mental health. You know, I do so many things about mental health on there. And I started this campaign called Pink Shirt to Work Day, which is to support bullying, you know, support anti-bullying campaign. And then last week, a fake Facebook page popped up called Stockport Talentless, and someone was copying my page and then uploading personal videos of me onto their page.
Right.
And it was really disturbing.
Yeah.
And what we had to do, you know, we reported it into Facebook saying, listen, this guy or girl, whoever, is doing this. They're promoting bullying. They're attacking mental health. And guess what Facebook said?
Freedom of speech, nothing we can do?
This does not violate our community standards. So what I did, I reported the video of me that he stole as intellectual property. Guess what they did?
Go on.
Boom, got them. Nailed them.
Right, yeah.
And by 5 o'clock on the day the page was found, gone. And then today, the page appeared again.
Oh, mate, I'm sorry to hear that.
It's pathological is the word I'm looking at.
Now, does it cross over into the realms of being illegal? Because once the Rozzers get involved, those things get taken a lot more seriously, a lot more quickly.
Well, that's what I thought I'd share with you and share with listeners, you know, because it's I've not experienced this before. It's disturbing, you know. I mean, I remember when we spoke a few years ago when Ian was in the jungle, and we talked about mental health then.
Yeah.
And I remember you particularly touched me when you said you took the phone call home with you, and you know, and the next day we did a show about positive things, and that was beautiful, mate.
Yeah.
Honestly, and I thought, you know, there's a varied audience out there of clever, smart people, and then I don't know what I'm saying.
Well,
it's just your brain's messed with it.
I think I can maybe there's a thing to bear in mind that's helpful.
Yeah.
Right, which is that what that person is doing takes some time, but not a lot of time.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? It's actually not that hard a thing to do in this day and age. So even though the fact that it's happening at all feels scary, it's more likely than not somebody who's just, you know, just got too much time on their hands and is being a bit of an arsehole, frankly.
Yeah, it ties into what...
Than it is anything genuinely, like, terrifying or threatening. You know, that's somebody for whom, you know, doing that is an anonymous and easy thing to do, knowing that they'll, you know, annoy you and get under your skin.
It hasn't worked, actually, today. I've been more of... I don't know. It's hard to explain. I'm sort of on the other end of the bipolar. I'm feeling like, you know.
Yeah. Just somebody quiet. Out there cares.
Yeah. I mean, you know, all my friends jumped on it straight away. They were leaving all these reviews on the page saying, grow up.
Yeah.
And stuff like that. And I spoke to the police and they were like, oh, it's not police matter. I went, actually, it's harassment. So, yeah, it is police matter. And then I messaged Facebook again when they got back to me saying, you know, it doesn't violate our community standards. So I got their community standards and sent it to them. I went, see that there, Section 4, Section 9 and Section 10, all them have been violated in this. And again, the page was taken down.
Well, I mean, that is encouraging. We would all rather that these things were dealt with a bit more swiftly and
of course, yeah.
in a way that lent us personally more of a sense of, you know, karma or justice or fairness or yeah. whatever. But we're still in the very early days of all of this technology. You know,
yeah, we are.
We've worked out that, you know, walking around the world, not shouting and screaming and swearing at people is how to behave. And now we've got a version of walking around, which is digital and virtual. And the rules of not walking around swearing and shouting and being rude to people haven't really been established yet. It's part of our kind of social evolution.
I feel like we're heading towards the Borg Collective from Star Trek, if you're aware of that.
Yeah, well, there's always that fear that, you know, there's a homogenization and that something unique to ourselves is being lost. It's chiefly that kind of thinking that is you know, badged and framed by those seeking to, you know, vilify people who aren't like us.
Yeah.
Isn't it? You know, the
exactly.
Was it old Tommy Robinson in the news today? I'm sat in the you know, the talk radio offices with the screens all blaring at me, so I keep seeing Tommy Robinson. But all of his like, you know, Islam is basically a organized paedophile ring and all of that nonsense that he spouts. Yeah. And then Cardinal Pell gets done up, and weirdly, not a word from Tommy Robinson. Funny that, isn't it?
It is.
It's like it's just, you know, it's just rebadge your racism essentially.
Yeah. Have you noticed that history seems to do the same cycle every sort of 100 years? You know, we're sort of similar place to where we were 100 years ago, you know, with Europe being in chaos again and the rise of the far right and the far left. And
yeah. I've got a bit of a theory about that. I think I used to think strongly in terms of the post-war consensus, you know, the reason we have an NHS and a decent, you know, social services and, you know, formerly slightly better funded schools was that after everybody had been through the ringer as a result of the Second World War, you know, everybody had lost somebody, everybody had suffered, you know, had their quality of life had suffered as a result of rationing or, you know, losing people, being bombed, moved on from their houses, separated from their children.
Well, that's how my grandparents met, because of the war.
Was it really?
Yeah. In Liverpool, that's how they met, and they were both put in the RAF. You know those people, when you see the films, when you see the women moving the things around, the maps and all that?
Yeah.
Yeah, she was one of them during the war.
Oh, very good.
And my granddad was engineer or something similar to that.
Oh, nice, man. Yeah, I mean, don't get me wrong, not all bad. There are good stories that come out of that time.
Yeah, exactly.
But I think that process as a nation of suffering meant that when that war ended, there was a much wider felt responsibility to one another to make everybody's lives as good as they could be. So we see the rise of social services, the NHS, all of those things, because everybody had been through it, and now we are going to make our lives better. And then the next generation gets born having not lived through it and doesn't quite value it as much. So do we really need all those council houses? No, we could probably sell most of those off. Well, does it all need to be done through the NHS? Because actually there's an opportunity for industry to alleviate some of this. That generation on generation it gets lost, sold off, then people's lives are made terrible again, which leads to, you know, the rise in young people of beginning to think more in terms of socialism. And,
that was the baby boom generation, wasn't it?
Yeah, quite. Like the baby boomers were born to parents who had suffered a great deal.
Yeah.
Those parents were looking at their children going, you're going to have it a damn sight easier than I had it. You just see if you don't. And we're essentially raised within an ongoing culture that all of this can be better and will be better for you. Well, now that same generation is saying, where's our pension? Where's our our healthcare? Where's our this? Where's our that? And
they lived in the shadow of World War III. You know, they had that.
Yeah. Growing at a time where any moment now the sirens could go off, and it's known that Russia's decided it's time to, you know, to call it all to a close. But anyway, that's why I think those cycles come round.
Yeah, that makes sense.
You whip up, you know, you utilise inbuilt mammalian hatreds to support your effort to, you know, extend your boundaries as a nation. War is then fought, everyone suffers in war, and at the end of that war people go, we need to seriously rethink how we do all of this and be nicer to ourselves. The question is, in a world where, you know, we have nuclear weapons and drone bombings and all of that, is the next world war one that we come out the other side of, or is it the one that ends life on Earth? Which, I grant you, may sound overly dramatic, but if enough nuclear weapons go off, that's nuclear winter. It's not just the bombs themselves. It's dust in the atmosphere kills life on Earth. That's a cheery thought for a Tuesday night.
I know it sounds strange, but I find the whole nuclear thing fascinating and a sort of morbid curiosity. But it's about 160 nukes, and we're dead. The whole planet's irradiated, fallout, nuclear winter.
And how many have we got on Earth? Thousands?
4,000 odd, I think.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah, it is terrifying.
We could tie it back to Doctor Who. Have you ever seen the one? It was like the prequel to the sequel to the Day of the Doctors, where Peter Capaldi is with
Osgood.
Yes, the two Osgoods in the box.
Yeah,
yeah. You got that before me, but when he does that war speech, wasn't that summer?
Yeah.
Oh, that was summer. That.
Have a Google. Are we allowed to play the audio off a Doctor Who clip? Anybody saying no to that? We're not sure.
Yeah, you'd be allowed to do that. Lee puts Buddy LBC
on. I know. No, look, it's not that. It's that because those rights where we would get them from aren't publicly held rights, it's that.
That's true.
So we might not be able to. But look, we're going to have some adverts now. So while we're doing that, everyone, whip your laptop out, grab your phone, Google the Doctor's speech. Can you remember what the name of that episode was?
I can't.
No, just Google Doctor Who Capaldi anti-war speech, and it will tell you everything you need to know about why diplomacy and working out how not to go to war to each other is the only solution that we can possibly tolerate as a species, whilst we enjoy these commercial messages.
The radio show for people who know the best part of the day is the night.
Late Night with Rufus Hound, in for Ian Lee on Talk Radio.
We continue, really, just working our way through the people who've been on hold the longest. And next up is Pablo. You all right, Pablo? Oh, I've not Pablo. Oh, the green one. Yes, hello, Navid. Yes, sorry.
Hi.
Bit rusty, Nav. Haven't been doing this for a while.
How you doing, Mr. Simpson?
I'm all right, man. I'm all right. Although I was talking to somebody the other day, because my real name's Rob Simpson, and Rufus Hound was started as a stage name. But by and large, the people that refer to me as Rob Simpson are trying to imply to the people around them that they know me better. And the people who really know me well all call me Rufus. So it's sort of is a weird backfire. It's like a power move, that, I think. Like, I know your real name. It's like, yeah, but it doesn't mean anything. Anyway, it's a slightly separate point, Navid. I'm all right. How are you?
I'm okay. I would like to talk about Tommy Robinson.
Tony Robinson, the American motivational speaker. No, that's Tony Robbins. Tommy Robinson.
Yeah.
Got you. Yeah, no, that's a different thing, isn't it? They both stand up and talk in front of people, but Tony Robbins leaves people feeling they could do anything, whereas Tommy Robinson largely leaves people feeling there's only one thing they need to do, and that's a hate crime. So come on, Navid, what's your point?
He always talks about he's so pure, like pure white power, pure this. But let me ask you a question. He's got brown, black hair. He's got brown eyes. His blood's red. They ink themselves with colorful tattoos. The shit is brown. So how are they pure white?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're giving the initial nonsense too much credibility. You know, pure white, it's not a thing. It's just not a thing. It's the rhetoric of a moron. You don't argue with it. It's, you know, to say, oh, you know, your hair's one colour, it's the same colour as, you know, feces, is, well, you know, what are you doing then? You're opening a door on people being able to argue that anything brown is therefore the same as feces, which, frankly, is more likely to end up with exactly the kind of white-led racism that we're rather trying to stop, isn't it?
Of course it is, but he doesn't understand what racism is.
No, mate. Like, again, it's like arguing, you know, like you'll never guess what this pigeon did. Well, of course the pigeon shat on your car. Because that's what pigeons do. Of course Tommy Robinson was racist. He's a racist. But you can't run what he thinks through some kind of you know, logic gate and then go, but I think you'll find he's caught out here. Obviously he's caught out because the philosophy he's espousing is one that's fundamentally only, you know, workable if you're an out-and-out dickhead.
Can I ask you a question, if you don't mind?
I don't mind.
Okay, when the British Raj entered India, they separated Punjab into two areas, India and Pakistan.
Yeah.
In that whole month, 1.1 million people got slaughtered for no reason, apparently. And I just wanted to know, what do you think about that with the royal family connections to that event all them years ago?
Well, I would take out the royal family connection. That's not to say that there isn't one, just that they're the spearhead of, you know, the actions of an entire empire. I also would like to very, you know, in a major way point out, I do not know enough about this for what I say to be viewed in any way informed. But the little I do know about it is obviously horrific. And indeed, the things that came after that and... you know, without wanting to get too involved in the Winston Churchill debate that was raging last week, you know, his actions towards India, you know, when he was in charge of aid and things that could go there, was also horrific. There is a long and deeply ignoble history of Britain's actions in India and in that region, but then there is pretty much everywhere on Earth. That's the problem with having an empire on which the sun never sets. If that empire was largely taken by force and ideology, then, you know, when we examine how we went about achieving that empire, we're not going to like what we see, because it is saddening and horrendous and inhuman. But we pretend to ourselves, you know, there's a kind of old historic. It's that idea of, you know, make America great again. Let's get back to the great, you know, putting the great back in Great Britain. It's all that idea that we were once the rulers of the world because we deserve to be. We have a king and a queen because God determined that some people were better than others and should get to wear a big gold hat and be treated with respect. But it's all a lie. All of those ideas are a lie. You know, we have no greater right to rule over another nation than any other. But what we did have was superior technology and a financial system that backed up using that technology to take all the things that we had no right taking.
Okay, the second thing I was going to ask you is, do you think Theresa May is a truthful person, and will she stick to her word that we will leave Europe on the 29th of March, or is she installing that she wants to stay in power and make up votes? So the issue gets shifted again.
Well, she's a politician. So the notion of truth isn't really one you can apply to that, I don't think. What politicians do is say whatever the thing that they think is going to be best for them and the thing that they're trying to accomplish in the short term. You just get to the end of every day. And if you're a leader, then you tend to think more in the medium and long term. But if you're just a politician, then it's just what's the thing that I have to do, you know, now to kind of just keep getting away with it. So ultimately, whether or not what she has said today is what happens will be defined not really by her sticking to her word or being truthful or moral or, you know, any of that. It will just be that the circumstances around it happening haven't gone wrong enough that they don't.
I personally think that she will not stick to her word on the 29th of March, or maybe 2 days before that day, that she's going to say something else and make up an excuse to extend it again.
Hang on, so repeat that? Because the point is that they're going to take a vote on the 12th of March, is it, I think?
Yeah, I think so.
And then if nothing can be agreed at the end of that vote, then they might seek an extension, isn't that?
Yeah.
That's the plan? So,
yeah,
I mean, you know, I think, whether or not those things happen don't necessarily come down to her being truthful or being a woman of her word or principle. It will just be whether the political circumstances have shifted, you know, in favour of that happening or against that happening. But I don't think there's necessarily a moral line here, because if these people were moral, they'd be, you know, pursuing what Brexit actually is, yeah. and keeping it in the realms of being democratic. Even all of the leading Brexit, this is the bit I don't get, and I'm not making a particularly pro-leave or pro-remain point here, but even the people who were really pushing to leave before the referendum were saying once a deal is worked out, there could be a second referendum in which once the detail is known, the people get to decide whether or not they want that deal. You can literally go on YouTube and see Jacob Rees-Mogg, currently I would say the kind of leader of those, you know, the voices that want leave in the most severe terms, saying exactly that in Parliament. So that's the only bit I don't get. Now that we know more about what we are getting ourselves into, how is it anti-democratic to put that to a public vote? That's just the bit I don't get.
Also, I was going to say is that Theresa May promised that she would invest in mental and social and adult care. As a blind person who's been trying to get social and adult care from a local council authority for the last 3 years, I think her words are a disgrace to the disabled community.
Yeah, but, mate, I mean, I don't doubt you're wrong.
I mean,
So much of the actions of this administration have been a disgrace to people of every star and stripe.
Of course it has, but for disabled people it's more because, like I've said, I've only been blind for the last 3 years and I've got to pay for my own care, which is the council is asking me to pay £200 a week, which works out to be £800 a month. And for that, I get 20 hours per week, which if you divide it by 7 is 2 hours and 30 minutes a day for someone to take me out because I need assistance to get out. Don't you think that's a disgrace?
Yeah, but I don't know what that's necessary, how that maps directly onto Theresa May's stance on Brexit.
Because she said that she's invested a lot of money in mental and social and adult care in the local authorities. But when you ask them, they always say that, oh, the budget's been cut so much that we can't provide you with that care.
Yeah, but that's, I don't actually know. I don't have those statistics in front of me. I couldn't quote you anything. But the vague picture, as I understand it, is that in every budget, they say, hey, we're giving an extra 20 million, 50 million, 5 billion, whatever it is, to those things. And then when the economists get hold of the budget and break it down, they go, oh, no, what you mean is the money that you'd already committed to spending, plus or minus a bit of extra here or there. But the costs of living in this country are going up and wages are stagnating. The greater service provision the greater the services that are provided, not by one NHS, but by a bunch of private companies, means that those companies then charge more. And so the actual what you get for, you know, any increase in money either is less or goes down.
But that's less to do with
Brexit than it is to do with the, you know, the continuing ideology of austerity.
But you could gather £1 billion to stay in power, yet she couldn't provide the people that look after the healthcare or the people that do jobs like the police officers or firefighters. She couldn't give them a pay rise, but to stay in power, she could pull out £1 billion out of thin air. Her words don't mean nothing.
I completely agree with you. Yeah. I mean, obviously, yes. Obviously, yes. You know, there's no magic money tree, but if we've got to give the DUP billions of pounds, then suddenly we can find it. Yes, of course, those things are incongruous and a lie, and you should be upset by them. But that's got less to do with...
As well. Her husband's invested a lot of money in the marijuana business in America, so she's not worried about it. They live in glass houses, mate. They work for the government for like 4 or 6 houses.
Yes.
Taxpayers pay for it, and when they sell it, it's pure profit. It's just like...
None of the people making these decisions are going to be the ones at the thin end of the wedge when the shit hits the fan. They're not. But you can't pretend to be surprised or outraged by that. If you're
I'm not surprised though. Outraged. I'm surprised and outraged by her words. Her words don't mean nothing. She's got no dignity. She's got no empathy, and she's got no sympathy with the poor people that are paying or working hard for her taxes, and she's earning was 150 grand a year plus expenses and house mortgage and that. And she then they stand in Parliament and say, "Oh, we'll review blah 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 like this." And then on top of it, to people who are on benefits and that, they put universal credit on or universal just to kick them down even more. I mean, it doesn't make no sense.
No. No.
You know what I mean?
No.
That's where I get frustrated. And that's
look, you know, if you're relying on you know, all various services to keep you out and active and engaged in the world, and you're not getting them, I can understand why that is upsetting and frustrating, and why you would, you know, you would be as animated about this as you are, you know, rightfully so. But
Jeremy Corbyn's the same. There is nothing.
No, he's not.
Him or all three parties.
I mean, look, I'm not saying he's useless. I'm not saying he's perfect by any means, and there are all sorts of ways in which, you know, he's deeply, you know, problematic even. But to say they are the same when it comes to, you know, the proposed spending on services for public health, it's just not right, mate. You're just well off there. I mean, and again, I'm not necessarily recommending one over the other, although if pushed, maybe I would. But
do you know why
say they're the same, you're just talking out the back of your hat.
Yeah. Do you know why David Cameron and Nick Clegg got in power? Because of students, because they voted them so many times. And when they got in power, they said, "Oh, we're going to up your uni fees to 9 grand a year." That's why students before voted for them. That's why David Cameron got in power.
No, again, Nav, old son, I think you're mixing half a dozen things in there. No. Wait. It wasn't that students voted for Tories. It was that a generation who were given free university education and grants in order to maintain themselves took that for granted. And when the opportunity came up to change the system and put in a couple of grand, then they voted for that. But it's never been the case that there's been an enormous student turnout for the Conservative Party. That is not how it skews. Young people don't vote Tory. Unfortunately, young people don't vote in enough numbers that the Tories can't get away with it. And that's why they keep getting on with it. Getting on with it? Getting away with it.
Okay.
But it wasn't that, you know, somebody came out of university with a degree and the next week went, right, hoik those fees up. And let's get the Tories in. That isn't quite what happened.
Who do you think the next Prime Minister for the Tory party is going to be? Is it going to be Boris?
Well, I don't know. But, I mean, frankly, I think we live in these bizarre times where if you told me it was Noel Edmonds wearing a party hat on his genitals with, you know, I love Jaffa Cakes written up his legs in marker pen, seems to me like he would stand as good a chance as anybody else. I don't know what's going on anymore, man. Do you? Do any of us?
You know, we used to. Boris Johnson lives in La La Land.
Well, I mean, would that he did, because there's no direct travel from here to there, so we could maybe.
How can you trust a guy whose initials are BJ?
No, well, listen again, Nav. You start from a place of how can you trust a guy who. It doesn't matter what the list is. It's Boris Johnson. Of course you can't trust him. I mean, like, it's like saying, how can I hand feed this tiger with my arm without it hurting? It's, your initial premise is flawed, old son. But look, it's been fun. We have to keep the lights on here at Talk Radio. And the way that we do that is by selling the ears of our listeners to big corporations. And you know what that sounds like? This.
Across the UK, online and on DAB.
Late Night with Rufus Hound. In for Ian Lee on Talk Radio.
Wagga wanna bow bow wagga da bow now bow wagga da bow now wow bow.
Why don't you pop the shirt on that chair over there? Sure. Crank up the radiator. Make yourself more comfortable. What's that you say? Those shoes are pinching. Well, kick 'em off. What? Warm feet? One sock, then the other. That belt's getting right in your way. Hey, I don't think you need to tell me what to do. And so on and so forth. I think you get the gist. I'm creeping myself out, and so I'm going to stop and instead speak to Jerry. All right, Jerry!
Like Tuesday, but it's Monday. No, it's Tuesday. I don't know what this was. I have news. That's a child's play come back on telly.
Yeah, we need a round window. Put us all, give us something we can cling on to.
Cling on. That's Star Trek. No, that's true. Klingons.
You sound in good spirits, Jerry.
I'm good spirits. Ghostbusters.
Who are you going to call? Talk Radio! Tell me that's been done. That must have been done 1,000 times, isn't it? That sting? Oh, getting shakes of the head through the glass. If there's something strange in your neighbourhood, who are you going to call? Talk Radio. If there's something strange coming in your ears, who's it going to be? Caddick. I mean, it's
all quite in the West Midlands.
Yeah, quite. Yeah, something like that. Well, Jerry, I'm delighted to hear that you sound so put together, I suppose, is the phrase I'm looking for.
It's good at the moment, but might go in a second. Usually, just takes a split second and I've gone, so I've just made the most of it. Where's Vince Cable when we need him? Never hear Vince Cable anymore. He's calling with his prophecies, saying how good he was. I'll never hear him when Brexit. I'm telling you, it's all Brexit. Is it still going?
Well, I think I get the feeling that Vince Cable's trying his best to be heard because the Lib Dems are the only, you know, true dyed-in-the-wool kind of pro-Brexit party. And, you know, if the polls are to be believed, that would, you know, be a representative party for about 50% of voting adults in the UK. And it just doesn't seem like anybody wants to hear what he has to say. And I'm not saying they should particularly, but I just think he gets sidelined a lot because they've got so few MPs that I think they're... It sells more papers and more airtime if you reduce it to the Reds versus the Blues without murking it with nuance.
Nuance?
Yeah.
Nice word.
That's sort of the world we live in, isn't it? One team says this, the other team says that. You have to back one or the other. You can't say, well, actually, there are good points on both sides, but really it's a mixture of the two and actually a bit of this, and neither of them are right about the other bit. It's we're all just meant to be, you know, utterly polarised and tribal and just shouting and screaming at each other the whole time.
Yeah, that's how the legal system is. In Europe, it's different. The legal system's totally different in this country compared to the rest. So it's very sluggy. So it sticks and mud at everyone in this country. Adversarial, and they can't pronounce the word. Can speak all right, but can't pronounce the word. But ever, it's a different legal system. They're very argumentative. Very feisty.
Is that something? I mean, if it's a different legal system, do you mean we need a different legal system?
No, it's more friendly than the legal system in Europe, the rest of the world. It's really dead aggressive, just in the British way, dead aggressive. But you need peace and love.
Yeah.
There's too much hate in the world. Into love. Make friends.
Make friends, that's
it. Integrate. That's one of the difference. We all segregate.
We've more in common than we have in difference.
Yeah, we have. People have special skills. Why do we have special skills? That's why people look at people in wheelchairs differently. It's kind of weird. It's not because we're separated. It's just you've got to all integrate. Love one another.
Yeah.
I've got a question for you.
Well, it's the only thing that changes anybody's mind, isn't it? Kindness.
Yeah.
When I was about 16, I started going to church, and we had a brilliant vicar, just a, you know, regular kind of run-of-the-mill local Church of England church. And the vicar, I think he's now, he might even be an archbishop somewhere now, a brilliant fella called Nick Aitken. But I remember saying to him that I'd walk past a proper old-fashioned Bible basher in the town centre, and I didn't know how to feel about it, because there was I trying to be Christian, but I see this guy who's really been really overtly Christian. And, it made me feel like, ugh, it's the last thing I want is to be in your gang.
Yeah.
And Nick Aitken said about that guy, he said, God and Jesus said, you know, call people to me. He said, when those people are, you know, shouting and screaming their heads off, they are pushing people away from God. They're not bringing people to them. And I think, you know, look, that's a point made to me by somebody I felt had great wisdom. But I think in all of our walks of life, we are, and it's, you know, just it feels especially prevalent now, we spend so much more time shouting and screaming at each other, and it's never going to bring people towards us. We're never going to win people over all of the time that we just see ourselves as part of a tribe that has to take a staunch position and then just scream at anybody who disagrees.
Shouting on loudest voice wins.
It's not how it works.
No.
If God couldn't pull it off, I don't see how we're going to be able to. And I don't even believe in him. Yeah, go on.
Just calm down.
Apologies.
I believe the only animals that commit suicide.
Say again, Joe?
A human is the only animal that commits suicide. Just thought about that. I know they want to, I'm just saying. Never knew about other animals committing suicide. It's just a thing. Just a thing that happens to humans. Do you know? Is there been any research on it? Just interested.
Yeah. I know you're talking about suicide, Jerry, but
yeah.
I'm missing some of the words before it.
I'm saying that we're the only animal that commits suicide.
Would you say it really slowly, one word at a time?
Are humans the only animal that commits suicide?
Oh, are humans the only animal that commits suicide?
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
I don't know why. It's just fascinating. Must be chemicals.
Well, I think the tricky thing there is that when we talk about suicide, you're talking about a conscious choice to end our own lives. And other animals do versions of that, but normally not out of, you know, depression or ennui, but more normally out of they've outlived their usefulness and they've ceased to be able to provide for themselves. Like lots of people with cats will know that if your very elderly cat goes missing, chances are it's because it just wants to end it. So it's not going to eat or, you know, it just wants to lie down, be still, and its time has passed. So to that end, it ceases to take care of itself and its life ends. But I think that's quite different to what we as human beings term as suicide, because that's born more out of a sense of not being able to continue, you know, because of what's going on in our minds more than our bodies. But even that then becomes very tricky, doesn't it, Jerry?
Yeah.
Because
is
depression a thing that actually is a biochemical process going on within us, less than it is, you know, simply a logical point of argument? Certainly people I know who have found themselves at a place where they didn't feel they could continue, it felt like a disease had taken them more than it felt like they'd just come to a logical conclusion of their own argument.
Sad times. I've got a fuzzy feeling in my head. I'm going to go off key soon. So I can feel it in my head. Going a bit fuzzy. So thank you for taking me call.
No, it's always nice to hear from you, Jerry, and especially nice to hear from you when you sound in as good a spirits as you do this evening.
Thank you very much, Chris. Take care.
Yeah, take care, ma'am. Well, look, we've got three callers who've been hanging on for blooming ages. And normally I would, wait, because I like to spend a bit of time talking to each person in turn. But if I do that, then as we've only got an hour left, I'm not going to get through everyone. So I might start with, Galen and just see how we get on quickly. You all right, Galen?
Well, that's me. Well, that's me, you know.
Yeah, it is. Listen, if we get stuck into something, Galen, you just have to stay on the line and we'll come back to you after the news.
Yeah, well, it depends what we're going to get stuck into, I suppose. Funny enough, like one of your two callers before, I knew it because of my grandparents to a Second World War, as it turns out.
Really? How did they meet?
Because of the Second World War, because my grandmother was Welsh, but my granddad was Scottish, and Scottish name and stuff. Anyway, that's how it happens, isn't it?
It is. Listen, you know, all sorts of crazy ways in which our heritage crosses. I'm sure there's a great song by... I'll tell you what we'll do. When we come back after the break, I'll see if we can play... There's a song by The Streets. I might have to Google what it is in the
I
break.
Know, it is a street song. I really like it, actually, but anyway.
Well, this one is from, I think, the last... Not is maybe the last album.
Album.
So, no,
album
this is from, like, their fourth, fifth album. And it's basically about a bloke walking along a cliff's edge thinking, that's it, I'm done. And this guy comes up to him and says, the thing that you've got to remember is this. And rather than just badly half remember that song, I'll dig it out and we'll play it when we come back. What was the other thing you wanted to talk about, Galen?
Well, loads, isn't it? You do on a radio before, actually. But loads of things. I mean, religion, for one. I'm the same way as you about that. Do you realise where it started?
What I've started?
Actually. No, religion started.
Concept. I think this is a... Yeah, go on. No, go on. You make your point before I answer a point you might not be making.
Well, we only start somewhere, can't we? I pretty much think that it started with shamanism, actually, sort of from the start. Which
shamanism?
I think so. So sort of.
Well, no. As far as I can work out personally, all religion starts because as human beings we just didn't have answers to many questions. So why did the crops grow in that field and not that field? Why does the sun come up at this point but not at this point? And we just had so many unknowns. And the fact that, you know, without knowing how all this stuff works, life continues, we think, well, there must be somebody out there keeping an eye out for us. And we just we just define all of that stuff that we don't know as being God. Well, once you've got that God, there must be something that we're trying to please, some being that, you know, is... That we're meant to do the right thing for. And once that idea exists in people's heads, then it's up to all sorts of people to go, yeah, yeah, and I know who that is. And he says that you've got to do this, otherwise he's going to be very unhappy. And he says, now you've got to do that, or he's going to be very unhappy. And look, I've got a book here that was written 300 years ago, 2,000 years ago, 5,000 years ago, that says, no, you have to do this and that and the other, because this God, the one that's in control of all of this, says so. The difference is that once we have the scientific method, we've got answers to most of those things that we previously didn't know. And once we've got those answers, we don't really need, you know, a stand-in God to you know, fill in for our lack of knowledge. We are actually able to study those things and understand them. But the people who represent God then wield the power, and then it's those power structures that get them to boss everybody around and is, you know, largely the ills for which, you know, allows the people with the power to conduct themselves in a way that benefits them and very few other people. The abuse of that power, as we indeed in the news we're seeing today. Once you have the power and God on your side, you can abuse it in all sorts of ways. Galen, stay where you are. We'll be back after this.
Late Night with Rufus Hound, in for Ian Lee on Talk Radio.
This is that song by The Streets I was telling you about. Have a listen. The lyrics are really good.
I'm really okay, thanks. There's nothing to witness. I said as I looked back from the edge of the cliff. The old man looking down, leant over the ridge. Just looked with a grin, as if a blessing had hit him. I slumped on the jut of the cliff. Just leave me alone. This is none of your business. I will, said the old man, but just one thing. And what he said was so lovely it stunned me. He said, I lay right there once to the edge of the rock. I was ready to jump, I was ever so lost. But this gentleman stopped and said something I never forgot. For billions of years since the outset of time, every single one of your ancestors survived. Every single person on your mum and dad's side successfully looked after and passed on to you life. What are the chances of that like? It comes to me once in a while. And everywhere I tell folk it gets the best smile. And then the old man walked away and out of sight. Till the sound of him hiking turned to the sound of silence. I just froze in a profound surprise, and from down on my pride I found a smile to my eyes. And for many days again I'd be passing the same cliff, and on many occasions I'd chance on the same thing. Laying in the moss, in the same way I was. Be another man looking like he needed a change of luck. So I'd say I lay right there once to the edge of the rock. I was ready to jump, I was ever so lost. But this gentleman stopped and said something I never forgot. For billions of years since the outset of time, every single one of your ancestors survived. Every single person on your mum and dad's side successfully looked after and passed on to you life. What are the chances of that like? It comes to me once in a while. And everywhere I tell folk, it gets the best smile. For billions of years since the outset of time, every single one of your ancestors survived. Every single person on your mum and dad's side successfully looked after and passed on to you life. What are the chances of that like? It comes to me once in a while. And everywhere I tell folk, it gets the best smile.
Not technically talk, but still bloody good talk, eh? If you are, you know, in a funny old place yourself at the moment, maybe that helps. You know, the odds of us all being here are so tiny that you're special just for that. You have a place and a value and worth just based on the tiniest chances of things happening. And it will get better. Especially if we're all a bit kinder to each other, eh? Anyway, Galen, where were we?
Anyway, on about different things. You're very philosophical there. Very.
Well, we endeavour. Very nice. Listen, if you can't be philosophical at midnight on a talk radio station, then where do we get the chance to discuss these ideas, eh?
Well, if you can't be philosophical in life anyway, to be honest.
Well, that's what I would say. A lot of people don't really hold with that, though. But yes, quite so, Galen.
That is the way it goes. I had a call earlier. They were on about, it was quite sad, actually, about burying people. But I've got a different story.
Oh, yeah.
Digging up people, actually, is not. Yeah, and I mean that. I mean, I've been an archaeologist anyway. It happens.
I can't tell you the sigh of relief that was just breathed by my producer. Very worried where this was going. But yes, archaeology, yes. The best form of digging up corpses.
I can't tell you the amount, but, you know, a fair few. You know,
right, yeah.
Fair few. But it's different, like, see, because, you know, it's done properly, scientifically. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
So, because we're always on a rush working in archaeology, actually. People don't realise that.
Some irony to that.
You've got to do it quick.
Yeah.
You know, quick time limits, you know?
Yeah.
So we can stick a road in, whatever.
Yeah.
It depends what we find, and that can slow us down, and bodies do slow us down.
Right.
Actually. It's different, see, because I think When I've uncovered them, I look at them and I think, well, the last people to look at this person,
yeah,
loved them. And as simple as that, you know, I mean, it's just the best way to look at it, isn't it, I suppose. It's got to be done anyway, because they can be destroyed by a road,
yeah,
or a house.
Yeah.
So, you know, and probably put in a museum. But anyway,
you know, with a bit of skill and application to maybe reveal something about the story of that life, and that's
there's loads we can take out. Of course, scientifically, of course, elements we can get from the bones and stuff, and not just that the way the bones look. I mean, you know, I can tell an archer. By the way the tendons go onto the bone. Anyway, it's complicated stuff.
Maybe we'll save it for another time, because we've got half a dozen people waiting, so I'm going to try and chop through it a bit more, Galen, but it was lovely speaking to you.
Yourself. I'll catch you again.
Yeah, until the next time, dude. Let's have a word with... Who are we gonna go to? Pablo, I think, probably. All right, Pabs.
Geronimo!
Hey! Incoming!
How are you doing?
Bobbing along. How are you, Pabs?
I'm all right. I think since last we spoke, I've started on a radio venture. I won't go into specifics. I get told off for that. But yeah, but I just started doing a community radio thing, which is all very good. Just finished that.
Oh, congrats, man.
For the evening. Just a horror-themed radio show. Quite niche.
Do you know a bloke? Oh, God. This is one of those occasions where I actually know the fella, but because I see him on Twitter more than I see him anywhere else, I've now listed him in my head as his Twitter handle, which is OCinnaman. Oh, God, what's his name?
Oh, Paul Finner.
Eh?
He's not Paul Finner. Another comedian, Paul Finner.
No. He's, I've got this weird thing in my head, right, where I'm so terrified of getting people's names wrong that the moment I go to say somebody's name out loud, my brain immediately erases that name. It's the weirdest thing, and it happens to me all the time. I know the bloke very well. I've had dinner with him. I've done live events with him, all sorts.
I've found since doing
Johnny
Maines. Johnny Maines.
But if you're doing anything horror-based, find Johnny Maines on Twitter and get him involved, because what that bloke doesn't know about British horror over the last 50 years, indeed the last 250 years, isn't really worth knowing.
Oh, cool. I'll try and get him for an interview.
Yeah, man, do it. He's fantastic. He edited a book called Dead Funny, which was horror stories written by comedians. And there were two volumes of it, which I made contributions to, and he is really great. So, yeah, check him out for your radio show.
That does ring a bell, actually. Just in the flavour of that, it was just whether... Well, it's a two-point thing, one serious, one not so. So the not-so one would be, if you're a fan of the horror genre yourself, is there any particular, like, unsung gem that you're a fan of that doesn't get that much plaudits?
Nothing really obscure, but definitely some things that I like. Was it A Girl Walks Alone... A Girl Walks Alone at Night, I think, is an Iranian vampire movie in black and white. That is a great film. Have you ever seen Tusk?
Yes, I have seen Tusk.
Kevin Smith's schlocky B-movie that was literally a riff they came up with on a podcast, and it made them laugh so much. Kevin Smith then went away, wrote a script, and then made the movie. I love Tusk.
It was very good, although I found, because it's rare to find somebody else who's seen it, to be honest. But I found that the problem with it, I listened to his podcast, the Smodcast or whatever it was at the time, where he came up with the idea, and then he got the idea for the film, and he was doing the film. But the one thing that ruins it for me is the fact that they play the podcast over the end of the credits.
Yeah.
I was quite invested in it. Like, I was thinking, he's coming up with a really good idea. And then it's just basically the two people who conceived it taking the mickey out of the entire idea. So it's just, they're basically just laughing at you for enjoying the film. And it kind of took it away a little bit.
I guess. But I think that the thing with Kevin Smith is he's got such a loyal fan base that to an extent they are making the movies for exactly the people that do listen to those podcasts. I think that the whole thing is done so tongue-in-cheek and is deliberately schlocky all the way through that last little bit at the end is like, yeah, that is kind of incredible that you could come up with that idea, refine it on a riff between the pair of you over half an hour and then sit down and really think, actually, this thing has got legs. This would be a fun watch.
Yeah, and any kind of body horror thing is excellent. And to be fair, with that, Red State and I think one of his other ones, they were all crowdfunded, if I'm not mistaken, as well. He paid for the film by taking it on a bus around America and doing private screenings and using the money in that way. So that's a good one. Yes, Tusk is definitely recommended, but you might want to...
And then the other one, which you will undoubtedly have seen, is Cabin in the Woods.
Oh, yeah. I love Cabin in the Woods just purely on the basis that technically it's the prequel to every other horror film ever.
Yes, yeah, somewhat. And basically, you know, I think at one point he was a bit more flavour of the month than maybe he is these days. But basically, you give me anything written by Joss Whedon and I'm in.
Oh, no, definitely. The character interplay with Whedon is a touch of class.
Yeah.
With that in the case, that's the more frivolity of talking about the way.
But on and the British horror, of course, Ghost Stories by Andy Nyman.
Ghost Stories.
which
won a Fangoria Best Debut Feature Award.
Yeah, and rightly so. But if you ever get a chance to see it live, they're about to. If anyone's coming back to London anytime soon, they're about. They did do it at the Lyric Hammersmith. Then it transferred to the West End. Then it had a little breakaway and was in at the Arts Theatre, just on the lip of Soho. And the Lyric Hammersmith are about to do again as another production. And if you can see Ghost Stories live, my golly gosh, that thing will grab you by the nuts and not let you go until curtain up.
I think it's April. I mean, my brother went down to go and see it a while back, but I'm just a poor northerner. I can't afford such things as that. If they have a tourist, I'd be very, very pleased. But yeah, so but that's a great film. Love that film. Saw that in the cinema, and it was literally one of the situations where at the end of it, I was kind of elated with how, you know, all the twists and turns, and there was a slightly charvery couple in front of us who were just like, well, that was a waste of money and time. And to be fair, we were the only four people in the cinema, but I enjoyed it, and the missus enjoyed it, so that's all good as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
But on the more serious note, are you familiar with this whole Momo thing?
Momo?
Yeah, it's just, it's been in the papers as of late. Sorry, I'm just getting on a metro.
Oh, no worries, man.
But it's, yeah, it's this thing which is, it was in the Sun on Friday, but it's, apparently it's this thing which started as a WhatsApp thing. It's kind of partly urban legend, partly not.
Right.
Where it's this weird image of this Japanese person made. He made like a statue of like a half chicken, half woman. And somebody's taken a picture of that, and the potential urban legend aspect of it is like a WhatsApp thing where if you get a request to be friends with Momo, they'll start sending you weird, horrible images and kind of blackmail you.
Oh, right.
And apparently the thing that came up in the paper was that some of the Momo imagery started turning up on some of the YouTube Kids thing. But I was just wondering if you'd heard of it, and apparently not.
No, I haven't, but we recently had to have a word with our two kids about, you know, access to YouTube, even the YouTube Kids app. It's just that basically because it really is the Wild West, you know, if something unpleasant for children to see is found, it can quite quickly be got off the site. But that doesn't mean that it won't be on the site until people complain about it. So, you know, your kids can end up seeing it, and then you complain and it gets taken down, but it doesn't stop your kids from having seen it. So, yeah, we've kind of knocked YouTube on the head in our house.
Yeah, I think the main thing it highlights is that even if it is all tish and sipsy, is that, you know, at least it kind of reminds people to be a bit more vigilant with the kids and what they're watching on there. But apparently it's kind of like a bit like what do you call it, the tall man, what do you call him, the creepypasta thing.
Oh yeah, the Slender Man.
Yeah, which in itself was basically just a competition to come up with an internet horror story, and then it kind of got legs, but tentacles, I think is the appropriate term. But yeah, but that kind of took on a life of its own, and apparently it's a similar issue with this. But what started to happen, and I've looked into it myself, and some of the YouTube things, you know, these kind of unboxing videos and things like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like there's a Kinder Egg one where they do like obviously other chocolate eggs are available. They do...
but none of them are as good.
Well, you know. But yeah, but they do like a Kinder Bueno where it's one next to another one, and on the other Kinder Bueno, it's got a photo, it's got a picture of this Momo character.
Right.
But other than that, there's nothing untoward that happens in the video, but it's just the imagery itself.
Yeah.
And
if you know what it is, it jumps out as you as being scary.
There's been hell on the parents' WhatsApp groups because apparently some children had seen this thing, and it's all. But it's become one of those kind of things where the parents asking about it are probably propelling it more than anything. I don't think majority of the children have actually seen any of these things, and even if they have, they've only seen the still image for a brief second. But obviously the parents asking their kids about it is then creating a situation of, well, I asked them if they've seen it, and they said, yes, they might have seen it, but when I said, well, what they said, they don't know, so I don't think they're telling me the truth. And I think it's essentially, you know, I don't think any of the kids have actually seen it, but they're just kind of becoming a kind of a mass hysteria kind of... boulder effect type of thing.
Yeah, I mean, you know, It's I mean, it's interesting because, of course, you're talking about that as being a kind of burgeoning urban myth and all of that. But at the same time, it does rather strike to the heart of the fact that, you know, this connectivity we've had and people being at prey to that and, you know, more trusting or innocent souls end up being, you know, a victim to, you know, I don't know, just being scared, terrified, misled, you know. And I think the story in The Sun, from just having had a quick click around on it, was that it's a way into your WhatsApp that hackers, you know, are then using to harvest your information. So that's probably the real warning there is more about letting yourself get hacked than it is this chicken sculpture lady might come and get you.
Well, that was the thing. I mean, my missus is a teacher, and she'd sent a message through, like, saying, oh, if the kid talk about what do we do? And the message came back from some very dismissive person at the high school, basically saying, it's not real. It's not a real ghost doing things.
Yeah, yeah.
Obviously, I don't think at any point did anybody actually think it was some sort of supernatural being. It,
no.
It is just kind of, just make sure your kids don't see the scary face.
But then, you know, on a less frivolous note, my nephew's school sent a message round telling all kids not to download any videos at all or media onto their phone because, let's just say, some deeply unpleasant content was found to be being passed around between kids. And and under the law, if you download that film, even if you don't watch it, technically you're in possession of illegal material. And not only is the material and the video clip very disturbing for children, it's actually illegal to own. So you could be, you know, had over in both ways. It's not the terror of all, but, you know, what if they want to talk about a ghost? What do we tell them? It's actually that there's all sorts of stuff out there that really is, you know, less of a kind of fictional or quirky horror and more, you know, one of the genuine horrors of what it is to be alive in 2019. So, yeah, none of us are as in control, you know. All the big companies say, oh, we can help, you know, keep control of all of this. But the fundamental truth is, as quickly as you can think you can control one bit of it, somebody else is finding another way to get material that just shouldn't be in the hands of children to them. For what purpose? We know not. I think other than it just keeps us all off balanced and terrified and, you know, not knowing what the right thing to do is ever, which as a parent is how you feel most of the time anyway.
Yeah, and the worrying thing for me is, I mean, obviously I love horror in all forms and all that sort of stuff, but you've got to be a willing participant, and a big part of this seems to be that people are kind of, like, just trying to lull people into a false sense of security. It's not too dissimilar to those Peppa Pig videos a couple of years back where people have kind of made their own ones and involved, like, all sorts of horrific stuff and the like, and it's, you know, it's just kind of like, if you're going to be doing that sort of stuff, you know, the kids will be watching, I can't quite understand what kind of really you get out of that. I mean, it's
well, I think it's largely that if your own life is very unhappy, then you get some kick out of thinking you're making other people's lives unhappy.
Yeah, or if you even think that far ahead, I mean, I think a lot of these people, it's just for their just own little amusement, and they don't really think any further than that, and that's the problem.
Well, and frankly, I've got a lot of sympathy for that. I think if you're just doing it because you think it's going to make you and your mates laugh, you're not really thinking about all the other people who might see it, because in yourself you just think, well, it's not for them. But it doesn't stop it falling into those hands and it, you know, having a negative effect. Pablo, always a joy to speak to you. Until the next time, old son.
Uncut after-hours conversation for the up-all-night generation. Late Night with Rufus Hound. In for Ian Lee on Talk Radio.
The voiceover man's not wrong. It's Rufus Hound in for Ian Lee. Just use that ads to catch up with Twitter. I think I've read all of it now. I'm up to date. So hopefully no one will be tweeting anything else for a while and I can stay on top of it. That's nice, isn't it? Simon is in the New Forest. All right, Si.
God mucker!
driving around, are we, Simon?
Not at the moment, no. Just parked up, waiting for my turn.
Okay, well, very good. Very responsible of you.
I know. It's because I'm overwhelmed, Lixie, because I don't get to speak to the old mate Rufus very often at all, so...
Time for a catch-up. Just kick back,
wind
the car seat down, find a comfy horizontal position, and pick
up
the phone.
Savouring the moment. Say again?
I said, just, you know, find a comfortable position and then grab the phone.
That's the one.
Yeah, man.
At least there's the phone that I'm grabbing.
So what's going on?
I want to go deep. I want to go deep, man. I want to go deep.
I'm ready for you. Right? I'm fully lubed.
I'm sort of thinking of, like, there's subjects that go around my head that not all presenters would be open to discuss, because the minute you say certain words, they're trigger words, and the presenter immediately has got his arsenal of go-to responses ready to fire back at you. And I just think with you, Rufus...
That might not be the case. Do you know, it's funny you say that, because I really was reading Twitter a minute ago. Somebody had added me in a conversation, so I was like, what conversation am I being added in here? And they were like, we quite like Rufus, but he does let the callers drone on a lot. Other presenters have no problem getting rid of people. And I'm I just quite like hearing what people have to say.
Well, look, I want your input into a couple of points that I think are valid points.
All right.
And I think that you would come from a respected point of view.
Well, let's find out.
Right, okay. Now, I got Ian tied up in knots once because the question I asked him was, what makes a bad person a bad person? What makes them worse than a good person?
Yeah.
And does a bad person know that they are a bad person? So that's not the question I'm asking tonight, but it's on a similar vein. Okay. Right. Just so you've got a brief insight as to where I'm going, okay?
Yeah.
Now, okay. We live in a world where we are dictated to by society as to how we may think, feel, act, etc., with regard to our feelings about other people, yeah?
Somewhat. I mean, I'm gonna agree with you because I think I know what you're trying to say rather than the exact wording of that point, but yeah.
If you think you can put it better, then please do.
Well, it's not that I think I can put it better. It's just that the thing you said there are some problems with, but I think maybe the overall point you're trying to make, I agree with. So the thing is, I don't think anybody is told what they can and can't think and can and can't do. What I think does happen is that as a society, we negotiate what we... A framework for what we feel and how we want things to change. Now, there will always be people on the outside of that, and because we're encouraged to be tribal and loud in the way that we communicate with one another, it feels like if you say something, everyone in the whole world screams at you, how dare you think that, you're wrong. Whereas in actual fact, it might be as many as 10,000 people, but that's 10,000 people out of, you know, a billion people who are on Twitter or whatever. And so actually it's a very small number of people, but it means everybody feels like they're being shouted at for what they think all the time. In truth, proportionally, it's no greater proportion than it ever was in human history. It just feels more that way because we carry around a little machine in our pockets that allows strangers to scream at us.
Yeah.
But no one is actually being told what they can and can't think or can and can't feel. It just feels like that comparatively.
Yeah. But if I said to you, Let me just. Before I say this, this isn't how I feel, but this is just as...
You're using it as an example to make a wider point.
To illustrate my point, yeah? Now, if I was to say to you that I am a racist paedophile...
Yeah.
Who doesn't like trans or people of alternative sexual persuasions, yeah?
Yeah.
You understand where I'm going with this?
A bigot in every turn, yeah?
Yeah. Now, if I have those tendencies, those feelings, and I can't turn them off, that's how I genuinely, how I feel, okay?
Mm-hmm.
If I never act on those feelings and use them to upset another human being, does that still make me a bad person? So what I'm saying is this. There is a huge percentage of people, I believe, in the population who do harbour feelings and sentiments that are not the correct, let's say, thing or way to be.
Yeah.
But because of the fear of what their reaction will be to that person, they aren't allowed to express. Having said that...
Well, again, allowed isn't the case. People are allowed to express those things, but then other people are allowed to say how they feel about those things being expressed. And that can feel uncomfortable, but you're not actually stopped from it.
But
now,
then that brings
if you cross over into hate speech, where you're saying, and because of that, we should all rise up and kill them, then yes, you are stopped from saying that, but for fairly obvious reasons. I don't think that's necessarily quite what you're saying, is it?
No.
It's like, we should all have freedom of speech, but that freedom of speech doesn't extend to shouting fire in a theatre.
Exactly, in a crowded theatre,
you know.
Exactly right. So what my question being, because I've always had this thing about right and wrong, good and bad and everything else. I find the subject fascinating. It's like the left-wing, right-wing thing. What is it that makes left-wing better than right-wing or vice versa? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But there always seems to be this go-to position that we have to adopt because it's the done thing or whatever. Whereas if that's
okay, so here's the thing, Simon, right?
Yeah, go on.
The phrases you use to describe this so far seem to rely on allowed or not allowed or told to, right?
Yeah, because Rufus, as I said, and again, I'd like to just repeat.
Go on, just say it. You've put all your caveats in. You've made your apologies in advance of the discussion.
Yeah, neutral perspective and all that.
Yeah.
The reason why I'm using allowed and words of that ilk is because I come back to the individual who may have one or all of those traits I mentioned, paedophile, homophobe, misogynist, whatever, yeah?
Yeah.
Okay. If he or she genuinely feels that way,
yeah,
then I don't want to be put in a position where I have to pass judgment on that person, which I obviously would do if I saw that person express those views.
Yeah.
And if that person is so inclined, is he or she a bad person? On the basis that they may never... Are they a good person, even though they feel the way they do, if they never use that weaponry to hurt another person... Does that mean that even though their views may be
despicable, bad,
does that actually mean that they're actually a nice person?
There's a few things you said, right, that I think are worth just clarifying. So you said, you know, if you're a paedophile or a misogynist or a homophobe, right?
Yeah.
Paedophilia, from what I can work out, is... It's essentially an extension of a kind of weird mental illness, right? Mm-hmm. And how control you are, how in control, you know, the people who find themselves sexually attracted to children are, I don't really understand. But what I think is worth pointing out, I mean, you know, hopefully this goes without saying, I'm not saying therefore it's fine, you know, or whatever. Obviously, you know, being sexually attracted to children is not fine. Let's just put those in those stark terms, right? That's one thing. But then you said, no, if you're a misogynist or a homophobe or whatever, well, that's not quite the same, right? Because one is a series of thoughts about something and the other is a mental illness that is somehow in your instinctive wiring, right?
But is racism and homophobia not in your wiring too?
No.
Okay.
Because... If you meet a baby, or even a young kid, and they see two men kissing, they don't go "ugh," because they're new in the world, and they just go, "Oh, is that a thing? All right, fine."
I suppose,
They see people of different cultures and colours, they don't go, "Ah, God, what's happening?" They just, you know, it's about growing up around those people. Now, the older you get, if you haven't seen that, if your patterns for what you expect to see have been formed in your own mind, and then you see something outside of those patterns, then maybe you do go, oh, I'm not sure what that is. But that's largely why, in big cities, multiculturalism doesn't really come up as necessarily a huge issue, because the generations, as they grow up together alongside one another, don't really see that as being a thing, because they've always known it, they've always grown up with it. So the patterns aren't established when you're young that it should be one way for it to appear odd and possibly therefore frightening when they see another way.
Yeah, okay. Right? I get what you're saying. Yeah,
so that is a thought process. So those thought processes can be changed.
I get that. But let me put it...
I don't think is the same as necessarily being born with a broken thing in your head that that does make you feel like you want to act in a certain way towards, you know, in a sexual way towards people that you obviously and very clearly shouldn't be. So those two things aren't the same.
Let me swerve it to something a little bit milder, just about, you know...
Let's just deal with what you've said so far, right? Because I think there's plenty there. There's plenty of food on the table. We don't need to bring out pudding just yet. Right? You say you can have these thoughts and feelings and you know, they can't turn them off. Well, the issue there is not that you can't turn them off. It's about your willingness to actually examine those ideas and be open-minded enough that you can have those things challenged. And the reason that it feels to me that there has been more of a shift towards a kind of liberalism is that as you know, we've had, you know, homosexuality decriminalised, and indeed, you know, within 60 years, the opportunity to be married in same-sex couples, generation on generation has realised, and not even that many generations within 60 years, but, you know, let's say three generations, for the sake of argument, you know... As we realise that love is love and gay people being free to live their lives as freely as anybody who isn't gay, it doesn't change anything for anyone apart from the people who are in love.
But
we stop demonising them. So the more that we actually witness what those changes bring about, and those changes are nothing, and in fact increased freedom, which then carries with it a kind of moral rightness and a good feeling about, oh, this is better, right? Everyone's able to get on and love who they want to love and be where they want to be. That is better. The more we experience of that, the more that we want to pursue that as an ideal.
But the thing is, Rufus, these are examples that I've pulled out of the big bag of alternative ways of life.
I would say they're not... I mean, you know, you do get into semantics with all of this stuff.
I know.
But they're not alternatives. Then,
maybe I'm not explaining it as well as right. Let me put it to you this way, okay?
Please.
Is it okay? And I think we both could reel off a list of examples of this. Is it okay for me to not like the way you live your life? Okay. Again, as long as I don't inflict my beliefs and anything onto you which makes you in any way uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Is it okay for me to... So let me think what I'm trying to say here, right? So if you take, for example, an Indian person and a white English person, yeah? Obviously, we have totally different ways of approaching things and totally different ways of living our lives, okay?
Yeah.
Culture.
It's called tolerance.
Okay, but at what point does racism become culturism?
Well,
what I'm saying
racism,
is...
Wait. Racism is a learnt pattern of thought.
Okay.
So that's the answer.
But if I... So I, for example, don't have a problem with anybody's colour of any skin or anything like that.
Yeah.
But I may not like the way that you live your day-to-day life, which is up, you know, that's my problem at the end of the day.
Should we make it very abstract, right? I love a sarong, and me and all of my friends love wearing sarongs. And you, as a committed trouser fan, cannot bear to see us all sarronging about.
It's so wrong. It's just so wrong.
That's what you're saying. Very good.
Yeah, go on. I'm with you on that.
Right. So at what point does that tip over into bigotry?
Yeah, maybe. That's what I'm saying, yeah.
Well, I would say to make any blanket statement about any type of person based on anything, skin colour, sexual orientation, below the waist fabric choice. you know, there is a bigotry, there is a prejudice. We all are prejudice. We all have prejudices. Our lives experiences, you know, the way our brains are made as the computers that they are, means that we take our experiences, we try and find patterns, and having found those patterns, that tells us what to steer, you know, our lives towards and what to steer them away from. The difference is if you question your own prejudices and go, oh, crumbs, I realise that I've, you know, I don't talk to that family on the corner because somebody told me they were Somalian and, you know, I was robbed by four Somalians and I've just decided I don't like Somalians. Oh, Christ, that's a prejudice, isn't it? Because that thing happened to me. My brain told me there was a pattern there that you can't trust Somalians. And now, oh, God, that's so stupid. I should see and get to know those people. And it may turn out that I don't like them either. But at least I won't like them because I don't like them rather than not liking them for the conjured up reason that I've got in my head that they are being judged by without ever having deserved to be judged by it.
I see what you're saying. I do see what you're saying. I think in some cases, in some examples, the reasoning behind your like or dislike for someone or one particular group of people is, you know, because of large... Well, I think personally, largely because of media, what the media do.
Yeah,
you know?
Very much so. And actually, the media were an enormous part in changing that. There's some fascinating stuff about reality TV, right? And we all go, eh, reality TV, awful. But actually, the shift in popular opinion that that happened in this country before we had gay people on Big Brother and what happened after we had gay people on Big Brother was absolutely enormous. I mean, there were all sorts of organisations doing all sorts of brilliant work before that and during that and after that. And there is still plenty of work to be done. All of those things are true. But as a wide cultural shift, the more gay people that British people saw on television and went, oh, they're lovely. Oh, hang on, all that stuff that they're all like paedophiles and you've got to keep them away from your kids and, oh, hang on, all of that's a lie. All of that's nonsense. All of that is the worst sort of homophobia and prejudice that we should exorcise from our society. And, you know, within, it'd be interesting to know, I think probably within about 15 years of, you know, Brian winning Big Brother, season 3 Big Brother, gay Irish air host, or what we call them now, flight attendants, you know, we've got gay marriage. It changes. When we're exposed to something that we don't really know or understand and then lose our fear of it, prejudice dies. So I suppose, in a roundabout way of answering your thing, is all of these things are governed by fear. And if you give in to that fear, you are a less, in my judgment, good person than if you challenge yourself to be less afraid, to be braver, and to take people for whatever category you want to judge them in on their merits. That's the challenge, is to meet everybody with an open mind and an open heart. Sometimes it might backfire, but that's the mission of being brave. It's easy to be scared. A warrior is someone who goes into every situation thinking, yep, I'm sure this one will be fine. And it feels like stupidity sometimes, but it's the only way to live.
Yeah.
Anyway, we've got to take some ads, Simon. It was lovely speaking to you. My prejudice is that there aren't enough adverts on this station. Let's put that right.
Late night conversation worth losing sleep over.
Late night with Rufus Hound. In for Ian Lee on Talk Radio.
We have ways of making you talk.
10 minutes till the end of the show. Two callers on the line. Only one can survive. It's a fight to the death! No, it's not. We'll just talk to both of them. It'll just be quick. Should we start with Dave? All right, Dave?
Hello, buddy.
You all right, mate? You all right, fella?
Yeah, not bad, mate. Yeah, I mean, just like to talk about this knife crime in London. What's going on? I think there was 3 incidents in 3 hours today.
Yeah.
Terrible.
Yeah.
You know, I think you've got to put some responsibility onto the police. You know, it's very convenient. It's a very convenient excuse for them to say you haven't got enough resources. You know, and
yeah, but I mean, in fairness to them, the police have been saying for the last 5 years that the myth that austerity created was that we could, you know, take money away from the police force, but it wouldn't harm frontline services. But when you actually look at how the police force works, it is almost all frontline services.
Yeah, but within that, it's very political as well in the police. I mean, they obviously want more resources. But what I'm saying is,
we physically do have fewer officers, on the beat. When you talk to policemen, they say that actually the thing that cuts all of that off is community policing. It's having officers on the street who are able to know who, you know, the troublemakers are, and be present and around, really has a huge effect on that. And the fewer officers that we have, the more increase you see in exactly the kind of, you know, gangs and tit for tat that leads to this rising knife crime.
Yeah, but they need to prioritise. I mean, this is getting out of order.
Yeah, but prioritise, you know, over what? So we should, take money away from terror attacks? Dealing with burglaries. Well, we should have less police officers going to burglaries.
No, look at the traffic police. How many traffic police are on the motorways?
Very few.
They could do all that now.
Very, very few. Again, actually talk to police officers about this.
Yeah.
There are far fewer cops on motorways than there have been in the last 20 years.
Okay, mate. We'll agree to disagree on that. But,
no, it's not agree to disagree. I mean, literally, Google it or go and speak to a police officer. Ask them. It is quantifiable fact. I'm not really having an argument with you.
No.
I'm just saying that the perception is this stuff is all spiraling out of control, the police are saying, it's because we haven't got enough funding. But some of the facts of the matter are that there isn't the funding to properly run those police services. There's not the money to train new police officers and put new police officers in. I think the Met says they're about 20,000 officers short, I think was the last thing I read.
Well, I think, you know, I mean, I would actually hate to live in London. My brother lives in London. I have actually lived in London.
But I live in London. It's brilliant.
Yeah, but I think it's going to get that bad, mate, that the government are going to have to put a state of emergency in. I mean, we've had...
Well, you're wrong.
Let me say, Rufus, we've had 3 stabbings in 3 hours in London.
Well, and there was a stabbing in Birmingham.
Yeah, in Birmingham. But
in a charity shop this afternoon.
Yes,
obviously, all of this is horrendous.
It's horrendous, that's what I'm trying to say.
But we've got 10 million people in London, not including visitors.
Yeah.
Right, so, you know, it's bad. And we should have more police. But you are drinking the Kool-Aid if you're like, I couldn't bear to live in London. You get stabbed the moment you step off the train.
I'm not saying that, mate. But, I mean, you know, the statistics are showing you're more likely to get stabbed in London than anywhere else. I know it's more densely populated.
Is it? I think that's absolute bollocks, to be honest.
Well, I don't know. I mean, you know, I mean, the thing is, I think it's going to get to the point where we have to have targeted stop and searches.
Stop and search.
You know, there's got to be tougher crimes.
Tougher penalties for crimes.
No, sorry, but tougher sentences for people carrying knives.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I live in Conway, right? It's a borough in North Wales. You know, we're quite popularised, but we have a very, very low crime rate. So why is knife crime so prevalent in London?
Well, it's largely because London is where people come because there's a lot of work, but unfortunately that means there's a lot of menial work that needs done. the separation between the rich and poor means that you have a burgeoning underclass. Even the people in full-time work are working below the poverty line. Because they're working below the poverty line, their health deteriorates. The amount of time they have to spend with their children or in their community gets ever lower. And as a result, there is a generation of kids growing up who feel rudderless, dreamless, opportunityless, unsupported, disconnected, and resort to all sorts of behaviours that all of us are appalled by.
I agree.
And you live in a little village somewhere where everyone knows each other's name. Postman Pat delivers your Amazon deliveries. And, you know, everyone's waving at their neighbours.
Yeah, it's not.
So you don't have all of the conditions that lead to kids feeling like the world doesn't give a damn about them.
I think you're right. I will agree with you on that, mate.
Well, I'm glad for that, Dave. I'm sorry if it got a bit heated. I'm going to have to say goodbye to you because Barry's been on hold for now 3 hours. So I'm going to quickly talk to Barry and let you go, Dave. All right, Barry.
Hey, Rupert, how are you, Rupert?
Hey, there he is.
Good.
Barry, I've saved you. I'm so sorry we've kept you hanging on right till the last, the end pickings, but I was treating you like the cherry on the top of the cake.
That's kind of you. I give way to the more erudite callers. There's been some good callers. I quite like Simon's contribution.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it, talking about that? There's a very good podcast called Tea with Alice, which is a very, very clever Australian woman. What's Alice's surname? It will come to me. Accordingly on Twitter, at accordingly with a single C, where she's saying, let's have difficult conversations. And Simon gave us the opportunity to do that this evening. So very grateful to him.
Yeah. Can I just send out best wishes to Ian?
Oh, yes, of course.
Rufus, you've talked a lot tonight. I've been really interested in a lot of what you've made a lot of sense, and there's a lot of callers made a lot of sense, but there's some points that I just jotted down.
Very good. You've got 2.5 minutes. This is all you. Ride it home, Barry.
Okay. Cheers, buddy. How's Mrs. Hound and the family?
Sorry?
How is Mrs. Hound and the family?
Oh, they're all right, but we, you know, if I tell you about them, we'll never get to the end of the show.
No. Anyway, just got about 5 minutes. You've mentioned tonight kindness, compassion, respect. Yep. You touched on what happened after 5 years of brutality and war. From a working class community, as a working class lad from a mining family, I was shown kindness, I was shown compassion, and I was given respect. I was given respect by virtue that we were given a nice, good quality council house. I was given respect and kindness by the provision of a job. I wasn't looking over my shoulder and thinking I won't have it next week.
Yeah.
And I was given consideration with an NHS service, education, and all the rest that come from that 1945 administration, which in my opinion is the best administration that we've had. Unfortunately, we've moved into austerity, and a lot of these problems are coming as a result of these people not getting the opportunities that my generation were privileged to have. That's the point that I would like to make.
Yep, and I think that's absolutely right. I've always viewed it as being, you know, the post-war consensus, but I think it's just, you know, this is the ebb and flow of a society. The thing is that the technology bumps up every time it comes back around and speeds up the rate at which all these things get out of control, and the severity at either end of the spectrum. Barry, it's always an absolute delight speaking to you. Until next time.
Rufus, again, likewise, I wish you all the very, very best. Hope to talk to you again soon.
Yeah, hope so, man. Which brings us to the last moments. If only Paul Ross were here.
And here I am. Great to see you, Rufus. Great to see you.
You were hiding behind the desk.
Did you notice you had to invite me in? Because I take all my life choices from the Vampires and the Lost Boys. I'll only come in where I'm mentioned.
Yeah. Well, that's if you start work at one, it's you and Vampire, so you may as
the
well obey the same rules.
The Vampire Chef.
Absolutely.
Anyway, on the Nosferatu show this evening, or this morning, we're crossing live to Grenada for the first time because we delight in exploiting the old time differences. We've visited over 90 countries now.
Oh, very good.
Earlier. It's also International Polar Bear Day, so it's a polar bear heavy show, and also we're investigating the dearth of something. Ooh. The dearth of earthworms in the UK. Intrigued you might not be, but we're going to explain it all later on in the programme.
That is exactly the sort of thing that I find fascinating.
Polar bears and earthworms. What more do you want? Take me now, Lord.
Talk Radio.
Join the Talk Nation.
Pick up your phone and talk radio.
We'll get you talking.